good afternoon, everybody. We've been in recess since a little after noon, and the hearing in HP07-001 TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LLP is reconvened. We were taking testimony from Mira Kothari of TransCanada. When we broke, the commissioners had, I think, concluded their questions, but I'm going to check again and see if you have any additional questions. And they do not, so Mr. White, redirect?
Yes, I do.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Ms. Kothari.
Good afternoon.
I believe we had some questions this morning regarding the special permit, and I wanted to ask you what would happen if Keystone were determined to have violated any conditions of the special permit?
If Keystone would have been determined to violate any conditions of the special permit, the permit would be revoked and the pipeline pressure would be derated as such so that the design factor would return to 0.72.
We had a question this morning regarding aerial surveillance, and I believe you indicated that aerial surveillance would not permit the direct detection of oil on the surface. Would there be any other way of determining that there might be a small leak or a pinhole leak through the use of aerial surveillance?
Yes, there would. There are secondary characteristics associated with an oil leak or a pinhole leak, and that would be vapor. So from the air, dead vegetation or dying vegetation would be a secondary characteristic which would, in turn, allow for the detection of that leak.
And over the break, have you had an opportunity to determine how many miles of pipeline on the TransCanada system has or uses the fusion bond epoxy coating?
Yes, I have. The total number of miles on the TransCanada system, which is currently coated with the fusion bond epoxy, is 9,042 miles.
And there was a question this morning regarding the pipeline incident on the Foothills pipeline. Have you had an opportunity to determine what coating was on that portion of the Foothills pipeline?
Yes, I have. The Foothills pipeline failure of 1994, the coating that was on that particular section that failed was double wrap tape.
Okay. And there were a few questions this morning regarding densitometers. Can you tell me whether densitometers are a safety device?
No, densitometers are not a safety device. They are a measurement device that is to be installed at metering terminals.
There was a question this morning with regard to the potential for human error in the application of the fusion bond epoxy in the field. In the event that there was an instance of human error in that process, are there safety measures or checks in place that would deal with that?
Absolutely. Once the line is in operation, operators are required to have an integrity management program in place to manage the life cycle of their pipelines. If there were an occasion where human error was involved in construction, through the use of the integrity management program with such particular integrity plans, such as inline inspection for the inspection of external and internal corrosion, dents, linear indications such as cracks, all of that would be found through the integrity management program by running these tools periodically as required by code in our special permit. Once these inspection tools were run, data analysis is performed, and areas which require repair would be investigated and repaired accordingly.
Okay, and if I could just refer you briefly to your direct testimony, Exhibit TCD6. And specifically page 15.
Yes.
And do you see in question number 46, the second paragraph, the first line references to figure 1 and figure 2?
Yes.
Are those figures the same figures that appear in Keystone's response to staff data request number 2-14?
Yes, they are.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, that's all the redirect I have. I guess I'd like to ask Lee from the commission. There were two takeaway items that were presented to Ms. Cathari, the construction plans with respect to visible range to see the pipe, and also the weight of equipment that would require a call to TransCanada to perform an analysis before it could cross. If we could have Lee to present that information perhaps tomorrow when we've had a chance to do the research. Is that acceptable?
It is to me. Do the commissioners have any objection to that? Okay.
And I wouldn't even necessarily think it would have to be tomorrow. Obviously, sooner is better, but I think we're going to be around for a little while. So,
understood. That's all we have.
Mr. White, could I ask you one other question? It's just maybe it's my own set of things here, but are those figures 1 and 2, have they been admitted? Are they in something that you've introduced?
Yep. They have not been admitted. And I understand that they will be,
if I can answer for Mr. White, they're referenced in Ms. Cothari's direct testimony, which was admitted by stipulation. So I believe that they have been by reference. But if you disagree, please do let me know.
I guess, let me ask you this. Have in the data responses, those... I guess maybe you want to, that first set of data responses, maybe that was just number one. What's your understanding, I guess, of the status of those?
It's the same as what I just referenced. They've been referenced in testimony. Those data responses have been adopted by the witnesses throughout their testimony in paragraphs, and I believe they've been admitted in that fashion.
Okay.
Could I inquire about that? I don't think those are on the website, though. The first set of data requests responses are, but number two is not. So none of that stuff that's referenced in here is on the PUC website.
I don't disagree with that.
I mean, we don't even know what we don't have. I mean, it's the bottom line because the ones on the website, is my understanding, is that the company was intending to basically incorporate those as amendments to the application. But it might be better, and you might give some thought as to whether you want to do an explicit introduction of those, offer of those as exhibits.
We'll reconsider that then. Thank you.
Because we don't get data response. We don't know we don't see those. Other than those that were filed then as sort of addenda to the application. And I think making sure that that's been clarified too as to what the status, even of number one, the number one responses, is just a good housekeeping thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
I apologize, Mr. Smith. I had one additional redirect question that I thought of while we were having this discussion.
Go ahead.
There was a discussion this morning with regard to where on the pipeline system there would be above-ground piping. And I believe you mentioned valve sites. Is there some further clarification you might provide with respect to that answer?
Yes. All above-ground piping at the valve sites is not under pressure. The valve is actually located below ground, and all that's above ground is the operator itself.
And is that above-ground equipment pressurized?
No, it's not. It's not pressurized above-ground equipment at the valve sites.
Thank you. That's all the redirect.
Mr. Rasmussen.
Just a couple very quick. There was discussion about the website where you have spill release information. Is there a distinction between a spill and a release?
There's a distinction between the commodity.
How so?
The specific information presented in the testimony was related to liquid commodity. 576 spills that were specific to the testimony.
Okay, but that same paragraph talked about spill / release, did it not?
Release in the context of a liquid spill.
Okay, what is a release in the context of a liquid spill? A release of what?
Of liquid from whatever containment it was in, whether it was, a lube oil tank or whatever container the liquid was in.
Okay. So is there any distinction between a spill and a release, or is that the same thing?
In the context of the 576 spills, it would be the same thing.
Okay. One of the commissioners asked you this morning about how much of the FBE pipe has been excavated to be examined. And have you found an exact number on that? Or?
Yes, actually, as part of the checking that was done over the break with respect to the 9,042 miles of pipe, approximately 140 excavations have been performed to validate the FBE performance.
Okay, thank you.
Is there other recross? Anyone else? Staff, do you have any additional? Okay. Take just a minute here.
Nothing. Thank you.
Commissioners, do you have any final questions? Nothing? Could I ask you one last question? On the 26 aerial flyovers a year, and then you characterize that, and I apologize for not doing this, but we had lunch, and I knew everybody wanted to get out of here. So, and you said that the 26 was an average, and if I could just, I'm trying to get a clarification here. Does that mean that you have a requirement of doing 26 per year, but that the maximum duration between any two of those that occur within a year be no more than 3 weeks?
That's right. The code, and I apologize if I misspoke or it was unclear, the requirement is 26 times a year, and exactly the duration between could be pushed out, but it must be done 26 times a year as per the code.
Okay. And one other last, and this, you're probably not the person for this, but just in other things I've seen over, I used to work for an environmental company for a long time, and I'm just wondering if there, and this might, you might not be the person, but in those aerial flyovers, are there any techniques such as remote sensing techniques, such as optical spectrum type of detection methods that can be used to detect the presence of organic, like aromatics, in the right-of-way area that you're aware of?
There might be. I defer that to Mr. Brian Thomas or Ms. Heidi Tilquist.
Thank you.
I had just two quick questions I forgot to raise. I'm sorry. With regard to the steel sheets that you mentioned that come into the plants, regardless of where the plants are, for milling and for turning to make the pipe, where does that steel come from generally, or for these specific plants, where does it come from, if you know?
There are many locations to which these particular coils and plates are available to.
Does TransCanada have to then send someone to that plant to inspect?
We do a pre-qualification of that plant to ensure that the steel quality meets our specification and meets the API specification.
So both TransCanada and the plant that's going to turn it into pipe for you there are federal standards or standards you look to, and the plant providing the steel certifies the steel will meet that requirement?
Absolutely.
Okay. The second question, does any of the raw steel come from this country, or is it come? Where are the primary sources for that raw steel?
There are, in fact, a number that do. The one that comes to mind is Mattel, which is located near St. Louis, Chicago area. So there is certainly an amount of the raw product that comes from the United States.
With NAFTA, all the changes with NAFTA, are there steel mills outside this country, around the world? I assume there are.
There are a number of steel mills across the world, yes.
In terms of the likely sources for the plants you mentioned, do you know what the sources are for those plants?
I think that question's been asked and answered.
Well, no, I'm saying specifically, there's a lot of sources around the world, but is there specific sources that they rely on?
They're relying on whatever sources they can have make available to complete our order to the API specification and to our TransCanada specifications.
Thank you.
Any redirect following up on that?
None.
Thank you, Ms. Kathara. You can step down.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kennedy, you want to call your next witness?
We'll call Heidi Tilquist, please.
Taking just a few second break here while our court reporter gets a glass of water and the witness gets organized.
Mostly.
Tilquist. Would you state your name and address for the record, please?
Heidi Tilquist, 1601 Prospect Parkway, Fort Collins, Colorado, 80525.
And are you a contractor engaged by the Keystone Project?
Yes, I am.
And can you tell me what areas of responsibility you have?
I'm responsible for conducting risk assessment for the pipeline.
What's your experience in that regard?
I've worked for 17 years as an environmental toxicologist and risk assessor. I've worked on a number of pipeline projects, including crude oil, natural gas liquids, refined products, natural gas. I've also authored documents, including a document on the effects of crude oil spills on the freshwater environment.
Did you file written testimony in this proceeding?
Yes, I did.
And how many pieces of written testimony did you file?
I believe a total of three.
You should see a stack there to your left. We'll look at the first is entitled Direct Testimony of Heidi Tilquist. Did you find that?
I did.
And is that your testimony in this matter?
It appears to be.
Do you have any additions or corrections? Well, let's not go there. Do you have another packet of testimony?
Yes, I do.
And what's that exhibit?
This is my rebuttal testimony.
And what's it marked?
TC7/R1.
And do you find TC7/R2 there?
I do.
Mr. Smith, yesterday in marking exhibits and introducing them, we neglected to mention the existence of TC7R2, which Mrs. Tilquist's testimony dated the 26th, which was filed with the commission. And has been here and on the record, but we simply did not admit that yesterday. I'd ask if we could admit that through stipulation the same way we did with the remainder of the testimony and call it exhibit TC7R2. I have copies for anybody who needs one.
And the identification of that is her rebuttal?
It's rebuttal. It's a second piece of rebuttal.
A second piece of rebuttal. Is there an objection?
No.
No.
We simply neglected to identify it yesterday
right.
In our list.
TC, what is it? 7-2 is admitted.
7-R-2.
R-2, 7-R-2.
Thank you. Going back to TC7R, have you noted any errors or corrections which need to be made in that document? Excuse me, 7D.
Thank you. Yeah, in TC7D, I'd like to make a few corrections. On page 6, item 20, we talk about the size of a pipeline spill. My SIR rebuttal that was provided, TC7R2, actually provides a table 1 on page 2, and that actually provides the correct values for spill size.
Do you have any other corrections?
Yes, page 7, item 22, about two-thirds the way down through the paragraph. Should I just read through these numbers?
I think that'd be helpful, yes.
The original proposed route crosses approximately 20.2 miles of shallow water supply aquifers.
Did I 20.2 instead
20.
Of
20.2
instead of 20.4?
Instead of 20.4. In the next line, we talk about sandy soils occur along, it says 21.6, that should be 22.1. Next line down, am I going too fast? Everybody got this? Okay. Next line down, the reroute overlies 5.2, it should be 16.2. Next line down, sandy soils occur along, it says 11.2, that should be 18.3.
Do you have any other addition or corrections to your testimony?
Just one more. Page 9. The photo numbers got identified incorrectly. So second paragraph, third line down, we talk about photo 1. That's correct. The next photo, photo 2, that's actually photo 4.
2 should be 4.
2 should be 4. Next line down. To the right says photo 3. That should be photo 2. Next line down, it mentions photo 4. That's photo 3. Four lines up from the bottom, we say talk about photo 4. That should be photo 3. Let me just double-check this last one. And then the last reference, is it says photo number 4 is the south pool area. That should be photo 5. That is it.
I might understand there's no more corrections.
That is correct.
Very well. So part of your work for Keystone, have you evaluated the risk from the Keystone project to groundwater resources in South Dakota?
Yes, I did.
And how did you go about that?
When we look at groundwater resources and the potential effects of a potential spill, we look at a number of things. We look at where shallow aquifers, vulnerable aquifers are. Vulnerable. And so those would be like shallow aquifers with sandy, high permeability soils overlying them. We look at where source water protection areas are, so where are people actually withdrawing the water and using it. And then we also couple that with fate and transport of crude oil to try to determine if a spill happened at this location, would there be any effects?
Did you say fate of crude oil?
Fate.
Can you explain that as to what you mean there?
Fate is basically if a substance gets out into the environment, it's how it interacts with the environment. So, you know, does it evaporate? Does it dissolve into water? You know, does it float? Any number of different things like that.
Did you examine the potential risk of a spill for shallow aquifers or source water protection areas or both?
Yes, I did.
Can you summarize your findings?
Yes, what I'd like to do is step through some maps so we can kind of walk through these areas together. Do you want to enter the maps, or should I step through them first?
We've got copies, a number of copies of an exhibit we've marked as 16, which I'll pass around. This time.
Yeah.
While we're waiting for your presentation to come up, I neglected to ask you before, in all respects otherwise in your direct and rebuttal testimony, if I asked you those same questions today, would your answers be the same?
Yes, they would.
Thank you.
It's going to be a little difficult here. I'm going to try to walk through, and it's going to the route through South Dakota. We're going to talk about where the aquifers are, where the shallow source water protection areas are. Thank you. And we'll look at how fate and effects can help determine whether it be any effects. It's a little hard to see. Come on, Ben. It's working a little bit. It's working intermittently. Buster, do you have a... Excuse me for a second. This is working sporadically.
Before we start, I should ask you, can you tell us what Exhibit 16 is? DC-16. Do you have need a paper copy?
I've got my copy. I should probably double check it though, please. Yes, this is a copy of 10 maps that walk through the center line through South Dakota, looking at source water protection areas along the route. We looked at a number of different resources in order to try to evaluate groundwater effects. We looked at U.S. Geological Survey data. We looked at the source water protection reports. We looked at cross sections. We looked at we got information from South Dakota DENR for the source water protection areas. We had various discussions with the agency as well. So this is kind of a summary of
I just wanted to ask before you start. So, if I understand correctly, these are maps prepared under your direction?
Yes, they are.
And I'd ask at this time that Exhibit 16 or TC-16 be admitted into evidence.
Is there an objection?
Is that that's not part of one of the other exhibits that have already been?
I don't believe it is.
Okay, so it's something new. I just want to clarify.
Yes,
that.
It's additive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No objection.
Mr. Hone or staff?
As far as I know, this is the first time we've seen this map. Is that right?
I believe so.
I'd like to study it. I don't have any objection to being placed in evidence, but I just want to clarify we've seen it for the first time.
Is that fair?
Perfectly.
And the exhibit was called TC-16, correct?
Correct.
TC-16 is admitted with that caveat that persons who are seeing it for the first time may have some follow-up after they've had a chance to review the exhibit. Is that fair?
Very well.
I'm going to make one note, too, for persons who might be listening on the Internet. The PowerPoint that is appearing in this room, you may access currently on the Commission's website, the same website that you're listening in on, just for your information.
Will it be readily identifiable by its file name?
Well, I don't know since I haven't seen it, but what's it called? Do you know what it's called?
Well, we can proceed and we'll...
Okay, please proceed and we'll try to get that to him.
All right, so just to orient everybody, here is the border with North Dakota. This green line coming down is the Keystone center line, and it's going to be hard for... people looking at this to see, but these yellow dots here are source water protection areas.
I should ask you for the clarification on the record. Are you referring to the yellow dots on in the middle of page 1 to the left of what's marked MP-227 and to the right of what's marked MP-228?
Yeah, so those are source water protection areas near milepost 227 and milepost 228.
And what are source water protection areas?
They are areas for protection of groundwater resources that are used as public water supply.
And did you determine where the source water protection areas are?
No, these are provided by South Dakota DENR.
you obtained the information regarding the source water protection areas from the DENR?
Correct.
Thank you.
We talked to, with a specific regard to these particular source water protection areas, we actually sat down and had discussions with the DENR about these. We did find out these particular ones are covered with 100 feet of overlying clays and tills. Now, to explain, if a spill occurred, it would have a hard time. Clays and tills are not very permeable, so they're very low permeability soil. So they would have to penetrate through that till in order to get to the aquifer. So having a 100-foot layer of till and clays are just it basically acts as protection to these source water areas. And the South Dakota DENR were satisfied with where we were. They actually we talked. Either if we went either way, either side of that, that actually posed more of a problem. So actually the location where it's at is offers protection to these deeper wells.
And when you say these deeper wells, you mean the ones we referenced?
Yes, the source water protection areas at, that we look at, the two dots at milepost 227, 228.
Did you find source water protection areas at other places along the proposed route?
Yes, we did. I'll briefly mention this one. This is another source water area. It's about 4 miles off the route. Again, we're talking about an area not only that's separated from the pipeline by approximately 4 miles distance, but again, separated from the surface is separated from the aquifer by, again, silts and clays 15 to 20 or 50 feet deep. So, again, that would act as protection as well as the distance that the oil would have to traverse to get to that location. Just going down now through the different maps, map 2, we'll just kind of cruise on past this one. There is, again, there is no source water protection areas within a 1 mile distance from this pipeline, either side. So that's map 2. Map 3, same thing. There's no source water areas in this along this area.
Ms. Tilquist, you said within 1 mile. I hate to interrupt, but you said within 1 mile. I'm not seeing any yellow dots on map 2.
Correct. There is no. Okay. There are no source water protection areas within a mile either side of the pipeline.
If I could, Commissioner, I'll ask some clarifying questions.
Sure.
What data did you request from the South Dakota DENR in order to place yellow dots, as we've discussed them, as source water protection areas on this map?
What we requested, because they didn't want to give us their entire database, they asked us for our center line, and then we asked for any source water protection areas within a mile distant of the route. So what they did is they provided us a shapefile that located each of those source water protection areas. The only exception to that is the one we just looked at on map 1, and that we just happened to have because that was along the original route before we rerouted the Hecla Sandhills reroute. So that was the only other spot.
So if I understand correctly, if someone had the entire a database from the South Dakota DENR, these maps, which are approximately 15 miles in width, might very well contain more source water protection areas.
That is correct.
You asked for ones within a mile either side of the proposed route.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so now we're at the bottom of map 4 near the city of Carpenter. What is it? This yellow dot here is the source water area. Groundwater in this area moves to the south and west. So if a spill were to occur from the pipeline, groundwater movement would be moving the materials away from the source water area. Further, there is 45 to 50 feet of clays and silts above the source water area again. So again, that provides protection for these groundwater intakes. moving on. The next source water area is near Iroquois. This is located along the west bank of the South Fork Pearl Creek. It's unclear where their water actually comes from. It either comes from an ancient river channel or from the Dakota Niobrara Formation. The river channel, if it was the ancient river channel, it would be overlain with 25 to 30 feet of glacial till and clays. They had some well boreholes dug in the area. Looking at the lithology, the rocks and layers, basically those indicate it's not likely to be an ancient stream channel that they're taking this from. There was not sufficient aquifer-type material to make a viable aquifer. So it's likely that it's not the river channel, an ancient river channel, but probably part of this Dakota Formation, which would be greater than 100 feet deep under, again, tills and clays. So in either case, they are covered by a significant level of tills and clays. And then groundwater movement through this area would be to the south and, mostly to the west. South and west. Next map. There is no source water protection areas identified in map 6. No source water protection areas on map 7, 8, or 9. And now we get to Yankton. There's one source area here. This is a surface water intake for the city of Yankton. It's actually upstream of the pipeline crossing. So in the event of a spill, the product would be moving down and away. There is a source water protection area in a light industrial area. It's right where the water treatment plant is in Yankton. In this area, Keystone is actually co-located with the Kanab pipelines. That's where that one is. And then there's another inactive one. I believe the other one is in here somewhere. That's inactive. And that covers the source water, the public source water protection areas.
Can you tell me why you chose to ask for the source water protection areas within 1 mile of the pipeline?
Yes. If a spill were to occur, you'd have to have a spill that could penetrate into the soils. And once it starts moving into the soils, if an oil spill got into an aquifer, basically it would pool on the surface of the aquifer. The oil itself stays pretty much right in the area of the source, but it's possible that with time what happens is these dissolved constituents can come out of the oil and they can start migrating with the groundwater. The primary constituents that we worry about are called BTEX compounds, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylenes. And we worry about those because they have high solubilities, and they have low water quality standards. So if we're going to have problems, it's going to be with those compounds. So when you look at how far does BTEX travel away from the source, there's been a lot of research. Bemidji, the spill up in Bemidji, Minnesota, was a place where they started looking at, but there's been a number of sources, spill sites that have looked at this. But what happens is BTEX concentrations undergo natural attenuation, which means basically that the microbes in the area are degrading the BTEX. And if you can think of it as a kind of like a very steep hill, basically the concentrations are high at the source, and then what we do as toxicologists, we have a little isopleth where you have per each magnitude of as the BTEX is degrading. So you've got a very high, you know, maybe you have a high concentration at the center, but then it drops off very quickly. And what they're finding is that in the majority of cases, the BTEX concentrations drop off dramatically. We've got concentrations, I think EPA found 75% of them. This is in my testimony, my direct testimony, but I believe it's 75% of the BTEX concentrations doesn't move more than 250 feet. But again, you're changing by orders of magnitude with just a little distance. So we're talking movement that's very, very short. So the idea that VTEX, you know, the dissolved constituents within this crude oil could move a mile is unrealistic. Basically, that VTEX is going to be right around that oil spill. So that was why we set the distance as a mile, because that is we would encompass anything we would be concerned with.
Thank you. Have you had occasion to learn about the Lewis and Clark Rural Water Project?
Yes, I do understand there's a water project that has a subsurface intake downstream of the pipeline along the Missouri River.
And can you tell me how a spill in the Missouri River or underneath the Missouri River at Yankton might affect that water source?
First of all, it's very unlikely that a spill would occur. But if a spill occurred, if there was a problem with a leak under the river itself, first of all, the pipeline is going to be directionally drilled under the Missouri River, which means with directionally drilling it, it's going to be minimally. Buster Gray could probably speak better to this, but it's going to be 50 plus odd feet below the river. So you've got quite a bit of overburden that it would have to actually leak up through to get to the surface. So that's unlikely. But, if it occurred somewhere close to the river, got into the river, let's talk about what happens if it got into the river. What happens with the crude oil is it's lighter than water, has a density that's lighter than water, so it floats. So it would be moving along the surface. The surface water intake is subsurface, so you wouldn't have any fouling of the intake. So the crude oil itself wouldn't be an issue. You're also talking about, we'd have containment that would control the crude oil spill. The one thing we would worry about, though, is that, again, like we're talking in the aquifer, as the crude oil is floating, there are dissolved constituents that, with time, can start dissolving out. Those dissolved constituents would have to then get out of the oil and get downstream and then actually get to the intake. So they'd have to go all the way through the water column at sufficient concentrations to exceed the MCL, the maximum contaminant level. It's a drinking water standard. The intake, my understanding is it's actually in the gravels, or it's in the stream bed itself. So now you're talking about penetration down and into the subsurface. It's highly unlikely that any BTEX could get into that. But even if there was a concern that was a potential to happen, what would happen is if the spill occurred, it got into the Missouri River, Keystone's notification program through their emergency response plan, they would be notifying downstream water intake agencies. These agencies would be testing their water. What happens is as a spill occurs, you'll have a transient pulse of material coming on down. So the water intake agencies would probably shut down their water as a precaution. The BTEX would move past if there was any. And then once they tested the water and ensured that it was safe for human consumption, they could reopen it. So a lot of things would have to happen in order for it to even, to create a scenario where it could possibly happen. And there's all sorts of safety things in place that would prevent any contamination of a drinking water source. I guess the only thing I'd add to that, too, is this project, the Lewis and Clark Water Supply Project, was built with full knowledge that there are already existing pipelines at Yankton, the Kanab pipelines. These are refined products which contain significantly more BTEX compounds. So they felt obviously comfortable with the presence of those pipelines, and they could handle any sort of emergency that might those might present.
Thank you. There's been at least statements, if not questions, regarding whether a rural water system or a rural water drinking pipeline or both constitutes a high consequence area. Do you know whether they do?
I do not believe they do.
And I'll show you what I've marked as Exhibit 17 and 18. I should say TC 17 and 18. Can you tell me what Exhibit TC 17 is?
TC 17 is the federal regulations 49 CFR Part 195. What we're specifically looking at is 49 CFR Part 195.450, which are definitions for high consequence areas.
Would you read those for us, please?
I'm going to drop down into here where it would be classified under Section 4. This is the only one that refers to waters. So it would be classified, any drinking water sources are considered, not any, I'm sorry. For a drinking water source to be classified as an HCA, it would fall under an unusually sensitive area. So then you get referred back to 49 CFR Part 195.6, which actually defines.
And is that Exhibit 18?
That is Exhibit 18. Now, under this one, when we look at this, they talk about drinking water sources. So in order for a drinking water source to be considered an unusually sensitive area, Part A1 says that it would have to be a water intake for a community water system or a non-transient, non-community water system that obtains its water supply primarily from a surface water source and does not have an adequate alternative drinking water source. So this one basically focuses in on the intake. The second item, the next one, is a source water protection areas. This is what we were just talking about on these maps. For a CWS, community water system, and a non-community water system, that obtains its water supply from a Class 1 or Class 2 aquifer and does not have an adequate alternative drinking water source. Where the state has not yet identified the source water protection area, the wellhead protection area will be used until the state has identified the source water protection area. So the rural water supply pipelines wouldn't fall under that. And then the third item for drinking water is it would have to be a sole source aquifer recharge area where the sole source aquifer is in the karst area. So again, these are protecting the sources of the water. They are not talking about the actual pipelines delivery systems. It's the intakes or the source water protection areas or a karst aquifer.
I asked to put exhibits TC 17 and 18 into evidence.
I have 17. What is 18? I don't have that.
Oh. 18 is Part 195.6, unusually sensitive areas from the regulations.
Well, I'm not.
It's coming.
Wait.
It's coming.
I don't know that these need to be admitted into evidence because they happen to be law or rules, federal rules, but I think we can actually take judicial notice that these are what the rules are.
Then I'll ask that you do that.
I'm going to do that.
Thank you.
finally, Ms. Tilquist, I'll ask you, you've been present and heard questions about the composition of the products that the Keystone Pipeline will be transporting?
Yes, I have.
What are you able to describe for us the composition of the oil, the crude oil product, which will be in the pipeline?
Yes, I can.
Would you go ahead and do that, please?
Basically, the Keystone Pipeline would be transporting a variety of different types of crudes. Those have all been previously described in the risk assessment that was provided. Keystone's crudes are, I guess, you know, they're not unique. They're being transported by pipelines already by Enbridge and in North Dakota. There's the Express Pipeline. There's also very similar crudes that are being transported all over the U.S., thousands and thousands of miles of these types of similar crudes. Crude oil in general is a complex mixture of hydrocarbons consisting of hundreds upon hundreds of compounds. The Alberta oil sands, the oil that's derived from there, has many characteristics that are similar to other oils, many that are from Venezuela, Russia, Nigeria, and California. So not many unique features. The part of the thing that I did as part of my work was I was looking at the contents, and a lot of the information on the composition of the oil can be found on the crude oil monitor. There's a website. It's www.crudemonitor.ca. It's a publicly available website, and it provides a lot of information on a variety of Canadian crude oils. Talking with Keystone representatives, they said that they're going to be shipping a wide variety of materials, but this diluted bitumen is going to be, they're going to be carrying two basic types of crude oil. One is diluted bitumen, and the other is a synthetic crude. Diluted bitumen, they said a good representative of that is Western Canadian Select. For the synthetic crude, there's a Suncor Synthetic A. And those, again, so you go to the crude monitor, and it provides oil assay information. So you can go and see various characteristics of these oils. I'm just going to talk briefly just about physical characteristics. And some of the components of the oil. Basically, both these oils are lighter than water. So, again, when we talk about the fate of oil, if released into the environment and it did get into water, the oil would float on top of the water. The constituents, as we've talked about, it does contain BTEX compounds. Again, these are the water-soluble compounds that we have greatest concern about from a water quality standpoint. They're water-soluble. They're highly water-soluble for benzene, and they have low water quality standards. So they are the ones we really worry about. The content of BTEX in Western Crude Select, Western Canadian Select, and Suncor, the total combined BTEX concentrations in either one of those are both less than 1% for BTEX, so significantly less than you might see in like refined products and things. There's been some discussion about naphthenic acids. Crude oil from Canada does, like all crude oils, does contain naphthenic acids. Crude oil from Alberta does have a higher concentration of naphthenic acids than some crude oils, but not nearly as high as others. Crude oil from California, Russia, Nigeria all have higher naphthenic acid concentrations. Naphthenic acids are soluble in water. They have a moderate toxicity, not nearly the level that we look at for BTEX. And then heavy metals, there's been discussions about, you know, what types of heavy metals are in crude oils. The heavy metals are very characteristic of the geology they came from. The most common ones are calcium, aluminum, and magnesium. the heavy metals that we are most abundant in crude oils are in these crude oils are nickel and vanadium. We're talking about looking at my numbers here, the Western Canadian Select was 52 parts per million and 125 parts per million of vanadium. There's a variety of other types of heavy metals present in parts per million, parts per billion, depending on the metal itself. There's mercury, but mercury is found in, again, all crude oils, and the crude oil out of Alberta is about 20 times, it's orders of magnitude less than found in other crudes, so it's actually a very low mercury content.
The mercury is 20 orders of magnitude less? Is that what
I'm sorry. It's orders of magnitude less. It's the median value for Alberta crudes was one part per billion. Other crudes from other locations were greater than 20 parts per billion. So at least 20 times.
Do you understand that anything might be or is going to be added to either of WCS or Suncor?
Bitumen, when it first comes out of the ground, when it's diluted for transport, they do add things to it, but that's already accounted for within the Western Canadian Select composition. So the BTEX is already there. That's what they diluted it with.
Will there be corrosion inhibitors or drag reducers or anything like that added to these compounds to move them through the pipeline?
There is the possibility of those.
It's possible. Is it likely or not? Can you say?
I honestly don't know. I know that the drag reducing agents are a lot of times composed of water, but again, they can't exceed the tariff, which is sediment water fraction can't be greater than 0.5%. So they have limitations. So even though it'll help the flow, but I'm not sure if they're always going to use it or partially or whatever.
Finally, did you have a chance to review Edward Miller's testimony regarding pipeline spill statistics?
Yes, I did.
Did you find any noteworthy errors in his analysis?
Yes, I did. I was trying to reconstruct what Mr. Miller had done because I've worked with this database for years, and I couldn't resolve the numbers. What I found was Mr. Miller had based his analysis on the PHMSA database has summary sheets that show yearly averages. And what he did is he based his analysis on those yearly average summary sheets. What he overlooked was that when there was a reporting criteria that was less stringent from 86 to 2002, and then they changed the reporting criteria, they made it much more stringent. What PHMSA did in these summary data sheets, just to keep everything consistent, was they said they would stratify the data. So basically, they took only the larger spills and the more significant spill volumes, the more specific significant events, and that's what they presented in those summary tables, just for consistency. But it didn't incorporate the entire data set. Again, the data set now, since 2002, actually incorporates spills of much smaller volume. So when we look at the entire data set, which is what we did, we came up with the numbers that I presented in my SIR rebuttal. And as Mr. Miller suggested, that it's really critical that you look at the entire database base so you get an accurate view of what spill volumes actually are. So he basically what happened is he, by using the summary statistics, he overestimated the actual spill volumes and other things. I'll just go on here for a second. When we look at the mean value, the average value of a spill, the number we came up with was 287 barrels. That's a mean value. There's another way of looking at an average value, and that's the median. Now, going back to basic statistics, the median value means how many it's a value where 50% of the spill volume would be less and 50% would be more. Now, the mean and the median are both measures of central tendency. So they're both averages. But it's important to look at both numbers together. I hope I'm not boring everybody. But when you see that the median and the mean are significantly different, like we're seeing in this, what it's telling you is that the mean is being pulled to one side, skewing the data, because you've got a few very large events that pull that mean value to one side. So it's very important to look at both numbers and to understand both numbers, that you've got a mean value of 287 barrels, which is, to give you some sort of concept of what that would be, that's like your backyard pool. If you fill it half full, that's about 300 barrels. The mean value of 3 barrels, that's about 125 gallons. So that's like a big, you know, those big saltwater aquariums when you go to your dentist. That's about how big that is. So.
Are you able to discuss the performance of crude oil pipelines relative to other pipelines in terms of safety, other pipelines being perhaps those carrying natural gas?
Yeah, there's been I've looked at the data myself, and there's been other studies that have looked at it. Historically, crude oil pipelines did have a poor safety record, but since the last 5 year period, they've been significantly declining. There's been a 57% reduction in the number of spills on crude oil pipelines. Not only that, but the volume has gone down, I believe, by over half. And a lot of that comes down to, for crude oil pipelines, is the improvement in corrosion detection and spill preventions. The data show that most of these spills, again, I mean, we're talking about a median value of 3 barrels, so most of the spills are going to be small, 5 barrels or less. It's these spills that, when we talk about the significant spills that were listed on the PHMSA summary sheet, those spills of 50 barrels or less, those account for 98% of the volume. So that's where most of the volume of the spills come from. I would just notice, too, that of all the spills, if you plot these, that 90% of the spills are going to be 90% of the spills are 300 barrels or less. So these very large spills we talk about sometimes of thousands and ten thousands of barrels are exceptionally rare events. They do happen, but they're rare. Just to tie this back to many of the analyses that we did for the risk assessment, I think it just reemphasizes that what we looked at were these larger spill events. So we're trying to, again, provide a conservative assessment to provide a kind of a framework for people to understand worst-case scenarios.
Mr. Kennecke, I'm going to butt in here a minute. I'm just wondering, are we plowing over ground that's already been covered in the pre-filed?
I don't believe so, but in any event, the witness is now available for cross, Mr. Chief.
That was easy.
As I, again, I told you I'm not a hard, a hard nose, I better say. Okay. We were going to try to hold the direct to a short summary, and thank you, Bill. I know some of that was responsive. One of the commissioners.
Just another example of Mr. Smith's impeccable timing.
That's right. at least one of the commissioners has asked to take a short break, so we're going to do that. And what's your pleasure? Five minutes? 10 minutes? It's now 20 after. That's a nice round figure. What's that? Yeah, well, okay.
That's a difficult question to answer, Mr. Smith, but thanks for asking. As long as I'm not under oath, I'll go ahead and say yes.
I didn't mean in the cosmic sense.
appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Sherry, are you okay to go? Are you done then, Mr. Kennecke, for now, or do you have
one more
kind of cut you off there?
One more matter, if I could, Mr. Smith. I've handed out a document I've marked as TC-19. and I'll ask the witness a few questions about it and seek its introduction. Ms. Tolquist, do you have in front of you a document marked TC-19?
Yes, I do.
Are you familiar with that document?
Yes, I am.
Did you create that document?
Yes, I did.
Can you tell us what it is?
This is a summary of the crude oil contents of the Keystone Pipeline. It's an overview of the types of crude that would be there. It breaks down by the various parameters we were just talking about. Just provides more details.
And I provided that to commissioners and parties, and I'd ask that it be admitted as evidence, TC-19.
Mr. Rasmussen?
All I would ask is when we bring up new exhibits during our presentation that TransCanada is as generous as we have been, I'm not going to object.
Your generosity is noted. Thank you.
Well, I think we're noting it as well, and it appears to be the kind of exhibit we might want to have that information, so I think it's useful for us all.
Mr. Smith, is your framework whether or not to allow late exhibits, whether or not it's prejudicial to a party, or are you using, I mean, what should we have as our internal measurement?
Well, I think that's true, but on the other hand here, I think, you know, again, Mr. Rasmussen has not objected, so there's, you know, I don't have much of a basis not to allow it. Yeah, I think that's fair. And other things, in all of these cases, you know, we do the pre-filed, and we expect everybody to behave in good faith, and I have no reason to believe that hasn't happened here. I mean, as we go along through the live portion of the hearing, things evolve. People testify to things, and areas of concern become emphasized that may not have been obvious from just the written documents. So I think some... we have to accommodate. We always have. In every case we've ever had, we allow. There's always a significant amount of information that comes in via that process, and that's usually a good thing. That's, I guess, my take on it. With that, Mr. Rasmussen, you ready to begin your cross-examination?
Yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I want to start with your just a few questions about your direct testimony.
Okay.
Looking at paragraph 7 on page 2, you note the proposed pipeline crosses near a water supply well in Marshall County and will cross an aquifer protection area in Kingsbury County. Where did that... the water supply well in Marshall County, that's one of them that is noted on the maps that were TC-16, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And
so that was by milepost 227, 228.
And I believe that's a well by Hutterite Colony. Is that your understanding? Or?
That is my understanding.
The aquifer protection area in Kingsbury County, is that also shown on TC-16?
That is, that's the exhibit.
Yeah.
No, that's, it's, what it is, no, I take it back, I'm sorry. It is the Iroquois. So map 5, the source water area in Kingsbury County is the Iroquois water supply that we discussed.
Okay. Now you had a few other areas that are shown on the maps that are not referenced here in paragraph 7 of your direct testimony, is that right?
That's correct. They were listed in... just give me a second. There's a summary of areas on my rebuttal testimony, TCR1. Page 4, Table 1.
What information was used to develop the direct testimony that was then subsequently supplemented?
That was our preliminary analysis, and we had done initially we had requested data on a more narrow corridor from South Dakota DENR. We went back just to just be very conservative and ask for a wider core just for the purposes of these hearings.
Okay. And again, that first time you asked for source water protection areas?
Yes.
And maybe we should define exactly what a source water protection area is.
I believe that is on the website for the state, but basically it's an area that looks at the recharge of an aquifer. It's protecting the water for a public water source, groundwater source.
Is a well on a farm, would that be a source water protection area? If that was the water supply for that particular location?
My understanding is that it would have to be a public water supply.
Okay. Is the Hutterite Colony a public water supply?
It's apparently considered a public water supply by South Dakota DENR.
Okay. Do you know how DENR determines where the public water supplies are? Or the source water, what were we just talking about, where those locations are?
Yeah, I believe they provide their methodology on the Internet, but I would not be able to speak to that in any detail.
You didn't go beyond what information was available to attempt if there are other source water areas beyond what the DENR provided you that's referenced on these maps?
I also looked at high consequence areas as defined by the PHMSA, and they were sent to us by Department of Transportation. So those were also incorporated.
The high consequence areas, there's a map that PHMSA has that lists high consequence areas, which would include source water areas, is that right? Among other things?
Yes.
And how did they come up with their map that lists HCAs?
They come up with that list based on consultation with state and federal agencies. The state agencies are supposed to provide the information to PHMSA. There's some interactions. They basically then take that information, then they disseminate to the pipeline operators.
The pipeline goes by some other smaller towns. Raymond comes to mind, and I didn't see anything on the map for a source water protection area in Raymond. Do you know why that would be?
I don't have a specific answer for that, no.
Do you know if there is a public water supply in that locality?
I don't have any answer. I don't have any information to respond to that.
Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about HCAs. As you testified before, the Code of Federal Regulations with regard to water defines an HCA as a USA, or an unusually sensitive area, correct?
Yeah.
All right. And you went through a little bit 49 CFR 195.6, which I think was marked as TC18.
Correct.
Right. And that defines a USA drinking water resource as a water intake for a community water system. That'd be the first thing, right?
Correct.
All right. And an example of that would be the water system by Iroquois, or I guess the one by the Hutterite Colony, is that right?
No.
That's not right. Okay, tell me why I'm wrong on that.
Those both were source water protection areas.
Okay, what's a community water system?
Water intake for a community water system, a good example of that would be like the source water area that we looked at for Yankton, the surface water intake.
Okay. Were there any other community water systems along the pipeline route of which you're aware?
There are other HCAs. Yes, there are HCAs. Let me qualify this. Let me think about this. There are some along in the region.
I'm in South Dakota.
There's lots of HCAs, drinking water HCAs in South Dakota. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm not following what you're saying.
Okay, where are they listed then? We've got, is there a place where we have all these HCAs listed somewhere?
Going to object to the question to bring up the notion that HCAs, as we've discussed many times, are considered confidential material by the federal government. And we might be getting into areas which require the discussion of sensitive information as delineated by federal agencies here.
And maybe I'm not making myself clear. I'm not asking about cultural sites or anything like that. I'm talking about water systems.
HCAs.
Yeah.
Which are confidential.
Okay, well.
Been designated confidential by the pipeline authorities.
Okay, well, I thought we had designated where those locations were, and maybe I'm wrong. That hasn't been done? Or is that in the submission somewhere where all the HCA water systems are listed?
HCAs are in the submission. They were filed as confidential and have remained confidential. The source water protection areas are not the same thing that we've just discussed recently in Ms. Tilquist's testimony.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out is what all these things are. You testified about an HCA being an unusually sensitive area, according to federal regulations.
Yes.
Okay. How does that differ from is a community or is a source water protection area also an HCA or not?
The definition defines a source water protection area as an HCA. But we're looking, let me just say that there are different databases. You were talking about the source water protection area database derived from South Dakota, DENR. And then you've got PHMSA, the database, which is HCA. So I've got to be real careful. There might be some overlap. I think I can say that.
I mean, can you give me an idea how many HCA water sources there are along this pipeline in South Dakota?
I think the information that we have presented encapsulates the extent of the HCAs. It would be a comparable data set.
A comparable data set to what?
The HCAs designated by PHMSA, I think what we presented here today, you'd have a good idea.
Okay.
I'm trying to just be careful here.
If we answer the question, we'll be delving into that area. If we have to clear the room and go into that mode, your client got to look at the HCA maps and sign the confidentiality agreement, and If we want to go down that road, then we need to take those precautions, I think. I don't want this witness getting in trouble with the federal government.
Well, I don't either. I don't either.
Can I ask one question myself about this, please? And I guess it's not clear to me, and maybe you have a regulation or something, Mr. Kennecke, you could either cite to me now or maybe later we can find it. But I guess it wasn't totally clear to me whether it was the actual identification of the HCA areas that's confidential or just those maps as some kind of a proprietary document, you know, as some kind of a licensed proprietary document. Do you have any light to shed on that?
Perhaps, if you'd give me a minute to consult.
Okay. I don't know.
Mr. Smith, it's upon a consultation, we've determined that it's our opinion, the applicant's opinion, that the information on the maps is what's confidential, not the maps themselves, and that going further down this line of testimony might cause problems of the kind we've been essentially discussing here for some months, that the federal government considers these matters extremely sensitive and to be remain confidential.
Commissioner Johnson.
And I'm probably outside of protocol here just a little bit, so thanks for your indulgence. But I mean, I do think Ms. Tilquist was right. We're talking about two data sets. Now, there may be overlap. I mean, the bottom line is DENR does not have the same rules, confidentiality rules, that the federal government does.
That's my understanding.
And it may be they're able to get at the information the federal government thinks is sensitive by talking about the state data set as opposed to referring to the federal data set. I mean, I'll tell you, and Mr. Smith said the same thing, we don't understand why this HCA stuff is confidential, but the bottom line is it is, and nobody here is going to break, you know, the federal rule. So, again, I'm outside of protocol a little bit, but and if anybody takes an issue with what I've said, let me know.
Well, I guess my problem is this witness on her direct examination came in here and testified that rural water systems aren't HCAs. I think I should have a right to explore where she's coming from on that subject.
Well, and absolutely, we need to explore all issues that you want to explore and that are appropriate. It just may be that we need to respect the law, and we may need to clear the room and shut off the internet and get to the facts we've got to get to.
Well, I certainly don't have a need for her to identify places she's not supposed to be identifying, but I am going to go along this talk about HCAs, and I guess if I get to a point where they think the room's got to be cleared, I guess we'll have to deal with that.
Well, I've thought we're there.
Well, I mean, I don't think we get there until you're asking her to identify explicit HCAs related to this project. And if we're at that point, then I do think, to be precautionary, again, I can't quite figure out what it is that the USDOT is trying to do with that HCA map business, but I think we should err on the side of caution, and we can always later make the transcript and the tape of the proceeding public if we have to. You know, if we're getting to that point, Mr. Rasmussen, maybe we should go in camera here for a little while and get to the bottom of that, just to be err on the safe side.
This is my opinion. If Mr. Rasmussen wants to know the question, if his client's aquifers classified in an HCA, if that's what you're getting at, then let's clear the room and continue on, because I would consider that to be part of the confidential.
And to me, the discussion of, in a general sense, what is an HCA, that's not confidential. What the federal rules say and how they're interpreted, that's not confidential. It's not site-specific. And I understand you want to err on the side of, and it's a good thing for a general counsel to want to err on, keeping us safe. I think with this proceeding in particular, unless we're pretty sure we're someplace where we shouldn't be, I'd like to keep it open.
Well, I would too, and that's why I'm just saying if we're getting to the point of explicit designations of what the current HCAs are, then I think we're probably at that point. But if we're discussing, honestly, if we're discussing why something isn't, I don't think that is protected.
And I think that's more where I'm going.
Okay. Well, until we get to what the HCA areas are that are delineated on those maps, I don't think we're there.
I'll ask you this. Are any rural water systems listed on the maps as an HCA?
I would say the transmission water mains in the system, as per se, that is not listed. Whether their intakes or their wells, I'm not sure.
You don't know that?
I do know that there are some. No, I will not. No.
There are none listed on the, or I'll strike that. Are there any listed on the DENR map that we have as TC16, the intakes for any rural water systems?
I don't think there are based on the locale, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Certainly the Webb water line, which takes its water from the Missouri River, is not included as an HCA?
I don't know that.
You don't know that?
It could be where the intake structure would be.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, let me strike that. It's not listed as an HCA in connection with being anywhere near this proposed pipeline.
I don't. If you could identify where Webb's intake is, you're saying around the Missouri River?
Out by Mobridge.
Could you show me on a map?
in the middle of the state.
Oh, I thought you said it was along the Missouri River.
It is.
Okay.
Missouri River curls around. And
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Can you provide me a map number, please?
No, I can't.
Okay.
It's not on any of your maps because it's nowhere near the pipeline.
Then I would not know whether there's a source water protection area because, again, we were looking at a corridor around it.
Okay. Well, let me ask. You testified that I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the rural water system, just the pipeline itself, would not be considered an HCA. Am I correct about that?
That is correct.
Okay. And so again, looking at the federal definition, and as we've established, an HCA is defined as a USA. As when it comes to water.
A USA is a type of HCA.
Okay. And a USA then in 195.6 is defined as the water intake for a community water system, or as they call it, a CWS.
Correct.
Or a non-transient, non-community water system that obtains its water supply primarily from a surface water source and does not have an adequate alternative drinking water source. What is the second half of that definition? What does that refer to?
The non-transient, non-community water?
Right.
Is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is, let me put it this way. A transient, non-community water source, I believe my understanding is that it's things like, it would be like a rest stop, things like that. It's people that are coming and going. It's not a public water supply for a stable population, I guess is the best way to explain it.
That's a transient non-community?
That would be a transient. So this is so if it says it's a non-transient, so it'd be a stable non-community water supply. So
do you know what that is? Can you give me an example of one?
I believe that this would be things like I'm trying to think like a cafe or a public water supply that would be a public water supply source like that. So it's providing water for a community, but it's not.
Mr. Rasmuth, I note that there's a definition of non-transient, non-community water system contained within the federal regulations. Would that help you? I don't believe it's on a sheet that I've provided to you.
Actually, I think it is.
Is it?
There you
yeah,
go.
It's on the second page.
So it's a public water system that serves at least 25 people. Over the same persons over 6 months per year. So that'd be schools, factories, hospitals that have their own water supply.
Okay. Would the Webb water system be a public water system that regularly serves at least 25 of the same persons over 6 months per year?
Yes, but it's not the again going back to the regulation. It has to be the water intake.
No, it doesn't, does it? It says it can be the water intake for a community water system. Oh, I see what you're saying. I apologize. Okay, you're saying the water intake applies to both community water system or non-transient, non-community water system. That's what you're saying.
That's my understanding.
All right. Looking at, again, at the second page of the document, right under the definition of a non-transient, non-community water system, it defines a public water system. And that's a system that provides public water for human consumption through pipes or other constructed conveyances, et cetera. Would you agree with me that the Webb water system would fall within, or any rural water system for that matter, would fall within that definition?
I'm just reading through it.
Okay, sure. Case. That's fine, yeah.
Yes, it would.
The under going back to the first part of 195.6, go to A2, where it talks about source water protection area for a CWS or an NPN CWS that obtains its water supply from a Class 1 or Class 2 aquifer and does not have an adequate alternative drinking water source. And then it says, where a state has not yet identified the SWPA, the wellhead protection area will be used until the state has identified the SWPA. Has South Dakota identified all source water protection areas?
I can't answer for the state. I know they've provided us source water protection areas.
Okay. Just the ones that you have then listed on the map there, is that right?
Yes.
Thank you. I think I'm done with that. Got everybody confused enough. You mentioned, going back to your direct testimony then, that the on paragraph 7, the pipeline corridor also passes through areas where shallow and superficial aquifers exist. Is that what, did I pronounce that correctly? Or?
Yes.
Okay. What is a superficial aquifer?
A superficial aquifer is an aquifer that's usually touching the surface. A shallow aquifer is usually 50 feet or less, and the superficial aquifer is touching the surface.
All right. And where are those areas?
There are shallow and superficial aquifers.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
There are those areas are mapped. There are some in northeastern Marshall County. Again, we've quantified these on GIS, but they're scattered throughout.
Okay. Are any particular additional protections taken when the pipe passes through those areas?
That would be a not to my knowledge.
Paragraph 11, identifies two public water supplies. Are those the ones we already talked about? And that would have been the Kingsbury County and the one in Marshall County.
Let me double check, but I believe that's the case.
Okay.
That is correct.
And I actually, are there more than that? We're aware of more of them now than just two? Or
that in my rebuttal testimony that...
Yeah, you identified some more, right. Okay. You testified about several corrections that you made to your original testimony, and we've just talked about one of those. I don't think you mentioned that one initially, but you also mentioned you changed some numbers for that are in paragraph 20 and in paragraph 22. Is that right?
Correct.
Why? What was the reason that the original report was incorrect with regard to those numbers?
With regard to item paragraph 20, as you're referring to, item 20. That was a number I had an assistant of mine calculate when I went back and looked at the data to confirm these numbers. What she had done was the PHMSA database they changed their reporting standard from the previous one. They used to have only barrels reported. Now they're reporting barrels and gallons. She didn't notice that there was two actual different units reported, so she didn't convert gallons to barrels to make everything equal through the data. So that was the cause of that error. The GIS numbers.
Before you go on to the next one, you talked about Mr. Miller's calculations. I think you said he overstated it, and you initially would have understated it, correct? The average size of the pipeline spill being 12 barrels.
Again, there's two ways to report average size, median and mean. The median is actually less than this value. It's 3 barrels. The mean is 287. That's why, again, looking at one single number, it's important to look at both of them in conjunction, and that's why I provided additional information.
Okay, and then go ahead. You were going to talk about the change in paragraph 22.
22 was I just had some the GIS staff look at this to confirm numbers. Because I want to make sure what I presented was accurate. And there was some minor tweaks that had been done with the alignment, plus there was an error. And so they gave me these correct values.
Paragraph 16 references the spill frequency and spill volume analysis conducted by DNV, and you note that they are an independent firm which is recognized as an industry expert on spill frequency and volume assessments, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I would like to have you take a look at that DNV report. Do you have that readily available to you?
I think it's in. I do not. It's a. Yeah. I'll have to find it.
We just said DNV is an independent company that was hired by Keystone to conduct this study. Is that right?
Yes.
Looking at page 4 of the report dated May 1, 2006, revision number 1, is that the one you have?
Yes.
Page 4, there's a table 3.1 that lists 17 factors that are identified as factors influencing pipeline spill initiation. Is that right?
Yes.
And then it separates out 6 of those factors as being potentially applicable to the Keystone pipeline, correct?
That's what the paragraph beneath it says.
And those are corrosion, excavation damage, and I guess corrosion, both external or internal corrosion, excavation damage, mechanical defect, a hydraulic or pressure surge event, flange seal or fitting leak, or a washout, correct?
That's correct.
What's a washout?
A washout is when you have an incised stream channel. It erodes, and the pipe is actually washed downstream or broken.
Okay. And these are all recognized as potential problems that the Trans-Canada pipeline could face. Is that right?
they are potential causes of spills like, that could possibly affect the Keystone Pipeline.
Okay. Turn to page 6, if you would, please. In the first paragraph, the third sentence, it reads, some leaks from small holes could occur for a long period of time and result in a large spill volume because they would not be detected as quickly as some leaks from larger holes. Correct?
Correct.
Do you agree with that statement?
Yes.
Page 23 of the report. In the first paragraph there, states that overall the likelihood of a leak greater than 50 barrels anywhere along the pipeline is estimated to be about 0.14 per year or once every 7 years, correct?
That's what it says.
In your direct testimony, I think it's in paragraph 17, you state that DNV estimated the chance of a leak from Keystone Pipeline to be no more than once every 7 to 11 years over the entire length of the pipeline. Where do you get the 7 to 11 years figure?
The DNV did the analysis based on diluted bitumen and synthetic crude as two separate analyses, and then they looked at different throughput volumes. Where this is in the analysis, I'd have to look through here. Do you want me to look?
Sure. If it's not gonna, I mean, it's going to take a long time. I guess you could get if it's something readily available. Or?
I would have to look through in detail. Okay. But that's where the number would come from.
You say that number is in this particular report, though?
I believe it is, but I can't verify. I can't find it right at the moment.
Because I guess I didn't see an 11-year number, and I'm not saying I couldn't miss something. I make mistakes too. But
well, give me a minute, then, please.
All right. Why don't you do that?
I'm sorry. I'd have to let me just check a number here, please.
Sure.
I need a calculator.
Sure. Do you need a short break?
That would be nice if I could, just to verify a number before I said this is the right number.
You okay with that, Reed? Take up so she can try to get an accurate.
That's answer. Fine.
Okay.
Oh, is this reverse bullet?
Good. You want to take a little break?
Yes, please. I may have a calculator.
I mean, I'm just talking a couple. We're going to talk in a couple 3 minutes, or are we talking a little longer than that?
It should be just a couple minutes, please.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, that, I don't think I've seen that. It is apparently on file as part of Exhibit C. But in there it talks about 7 to 11 years as opposed to just 7 years. Is that my understanding?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I can take take a look at that. I'm sorry, you said what page again, though? I didn't write
page
that.
Page 23.
Okay. All right, thank you. Turning back then on, continuing with the DNV report, back to page 19 of that, table 5.2 discusses the detection and verification, correct?
Yes, it does.
And that indicates for a leak less than 1.5%, in below ground pipe, it could take up to 90 days to be detected. Is that correct?
That's what the DMV based their analysis on. I think Brian Thomas will testify on the actual leak detection capabilities.
Okay. Looking again then at paragraph 17 of your direct testimony, and that's the one where you mentioned the 7 to 11 years, but then in the last sentence of that paragraph, you make use of the 7-year interval in reaching the opinion that equates to a spill no more than once every 41 years at any one location in South Dakota, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, that's obviously just a statistical analysis. It certainly could happen more frequently than once every 41 years.
There is the potential for it to do that. However, I think DMV used a lot of conservative assumptions, so we're assuming that that would be a no more than.
Okay. Well, I know, you know, in Aberdeen this last May, we had a 500-year flood, and, you know, we certainly can't be guaranteed we're not going to have another 500-year flood next year, can we? I mean, it could happen, right?
That would be the statistics, yes.
Okay. And even if it is once for 41 years, this pipeline is supposed to be around for 50 years. So we're looking at least they're saying there's going to be at least one leak on the pipeline in South Dakota.
Again, what we're talking about is statistics. And then statistics are expressions of a probability. And, again, I've used the analogy in my – I don't know if you want to go through my direct testimony. I think we talked about the analogy with the car insurance, and I don't know if we want to go through that again.
We can read it. But I know what you're talking about.
So. Okay.
Sorry, I had just a couple more questions on that DNV report. Put away too soon. Page 24.
Of which version?
The one I was, the May 06 version.
Thank you.
That indicates under, in the second paragraph below the graph that approximately 53.5% of the spills would be from pinholes. Is that right?
That's what it says.
And then going under in the next section, section 6.2, in general, reported incidents over decades provide a good basis for estimating spill volumes and frequencies for new pipelines. However, there are weaknesses in the use of that data. Small volume spills are significantly underreported, correct?
That's what it says. And again, I would say that, again, we testified earlier about, you know, small volumes, the less than 50 barrels spills, you know, they are reported more frequently with the change in the PHMSA reporting criteria, but they have been decreasing. And the majority of the volume, 98%, is these larger spills, 50 barrels or more.
And then it mentions extremely infrequent events may not have occurred during the period of data collection of incidents. What does that mean, if you know?
Let me just read it, but I think I do know.
Okay.
What I think there's DMV is saying in this case is that highly improbable events, so a very large spill, may not have occurred during the period the data set, the time period the data set was collected.
Okay, I think I'm done with that then. Paragraph 19 of your direct testimony on page 6, which would be the top of page 6, states that Keystone will adopt a number of measures to minimize the chance of a pipeline leak or spill. You've been here through the course of the testimony over the last couple of days, is that right?
I was here today. I was listening on the Internet yesterday.
Are there any measures to minimize leaks or spills that you're aware of that haven't already been discussed by all the other witnesses who have testified?
I believe that a lot of them have been discussed. A lot of them are in the PHMSA waiver. I think there's a lot of things in the regulations, and I believe Brian Thomas will be coming up and talking about some other things too.
Nothing pops out with you, though, that hasn't, that would fall into the category of a number of measures that you talk about in your direct testimony?
Nothing, no.
Okay. Paragraph 21 on page 6 says the majority of the pipeline, approximately 80%, is underlain by low permeability soils. Is that a reference to the entire pipeline or just the South Dakota section?
That is actually a reference to the entire pipeline.
All right. Do you know what that number would be in South Dakota?
I don't have a percentage, but item number 22 talks about shallow aquifers, and then we talk about sandy soils. I do have a number for co-located along that's 8.15 miles. Now, that doesn't necessarily equate, though, to these are sandy soils, so that's the surface soils. Again, there might be confining layers between those, so it doesn't necessarily equate necessarily directly to the vulnerable aquifers.
Paragraph 23 refers to a recent report evaluated over 5 sites with BTEX contamination. Is that report on file?
That actually says 500 sites.
What did I say?
5.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
All right.
The citation, when I came out of a Minnesota Public Control Agency that's on the web. There's also the U.S. EPA in 1999 published information on this. There's quite a number of references that go back to these studies.
Okay. Well, when
it's not filed on – I don't think it's been filed with the commission.
Okay. This is just referring to one particular report, is it not, though, that statement?
Yes.
Okay. And that report isn't on file as far as you know?
That is my understanding.
Page 9 would be part of paragraph 26, refers to the Bemidji spill and notes that it was caused by defective pipe manufactured in the 1950s. Do you know when the pipe that was involved in the more recent incident in Clearbrook, Minnesota was manufactured?
I do not.
Couple questions about the
American Water Works Association study that you have attached to, I think it's your first rebuttal testimony. Or, is that right?
All right.
There's both a study and then another document. Would this be called an abstract or a summary, that first document?
The first document is the website by the AWWA Research Foundation.
Okay.
And basically just provides an overview of the document.
Okay. Looking at that the website from AWWA under the background section, it talks about pollutants from leaking storage tanks, and I understand we don't have any storage tanks involved, but if there were a leak of a substantial amount of product, would the soil be considered contaminated?
Yes, it would.
Okay. And it states that contaminated soils can and have posed serious threats to the longevity and structural integrity of plastic pipes and elastomeric gaskets, which in turn can affect the water quality in the distribution system. Do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I would agree with it. However, that was the reason that they did this research. And what they have shown is that when they talk about contaminated soils, they're looking at what they were looking at was gasoline, benzene, toluene, TCE, those compounds. They were looking at a variety of pipelines, too. They were looking at polyethylene, polyvinyl carbonate, the PVC, and ductile iron. What they said was that some pipes, the results, if you want to get back to the what the results say, is basically PE pipe, polyethylene pipe, is not very good at protecting against contamination. PE pipe is actually used, it was another more work out of the same group, is it's 0.018% of all water mains are PE, so it's not a commonly used water main. For PVC pipe, basically they said PVC pipe, this is under the second page under PVC pipe, it says it's impervious to gasoline because there's basically not enough BTEX in the gasoline to swell the PVC and cause permeation. So the spills of benzene, toluene, and TCE, now those would be the solvents, not, they'd be in isolated compounds. Those in direct contact with those solvents, that could permeate, but it would have to be the solvent itself or groundwater concentrations greater than 60% maximum solubility. So we actually talked to the author of the study, and his results was in here, what's in my testimony. Basically, gasoline is not going to cause a permeation of PVC pipe, is what I learned. And the BTEX concentration in crude oil pipelines is significantly less than that in gasoline. So, what I learned was that these studies are showing that something with concentrations of BTEX as low as crude oil would not be permeating PVC pipe or ductile iron.
Do you know what type of pipe is used in the rural water systems in South Dakota?
It would be secondhand knowledge. From what I've heard, my understanding is that it's PVC pipe and ductile iron. But I'm not. That's wasn't firsthand knowledge.
The highlights on the web page mention that BTEX will permeate gaskets. Is that right?
It can permeate the gaskets. And so, again, having talked with the guy and reading this research, what he's saying is if you got gasoline surrounding these pipes, that the gasoline can permeate through the normal gaskets that they use. But as long as the recommendations of the American Water Works Association's Research Foundation now is basically as long as you keep a minimum flow in there, you won't exceed the maximum contaminant level for these compounds. If they were to stop the water and stagnate it, That was the only gasoline-saturated groundwater. That's when those could potentially pose a problem. But he said, and what I've read is basically this gasoline contamination surrounding the pipeline, again, heavy, very high-level contamination, and with BTEX concentrations in the crude oil being as low as they are, the expectation was that that probably would not even be an effect, especially, again, if you keep a minimum water flow, there would not be any issues. And they come down to the end and they talk about their recommendations, and they said that the gaskets that are already there are satisfactory. And other considerations, engineering considerations other than permeation, should be used to govern the material selection. They basically say that PVC pipe is suitable. Long-standing recommendations and practices for these pipes and gaskets in hydrocarbon contamination have been unnecessarily conservative.
He also concludes on page 17 of the actual report that utilities prefer copper services in areas of known contamination, and replacement with copper was the corrective action for all reported permeation incidents involving domestic services.
Correct, and that's for a service line, not a main distribution.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I believe PE is used a lot more on service lines, too.
Was there any particular person that you dealt with at DENR?
I did not. The people I was in charge of actually were the ones that actually consulted. I believe it was Brian Walsh and there was a second person that they had a conversation. I think actually a third person was brought into one conversation about the Marshall area because they just wanted to make sure they got the right answer.
Right answer to what?
Whether we were concerned about where our pipeline was in relationship to these source water areas, and we wanted to ensure that these source water areas would be basically they were protected from a spill. And that when we talked to them about these areas, they talked to us about the overlying till, the depth of the actual well. They actually went and looked at the bore logs to look at the lithology to ensure that in the event of a spill, again, this would be low permeability soils, and the well depth was sufficient that they were comfortable where our pipeline was.
Thank you, ma'am. That's all I have.
Commissioners, do you want to proceed or take a break or forge ahead? You guys okay?
If we're going to go for a while, I would appreciate a break. I might be scooting out here by myself, then.
Are we okay with a short with a break? Do you want to? What do you want to take at this point? 10-minute break?
We'll say 7 and mean 10.
Okay. All right. At this moment, it is 25-4, if my eyesight serves me right. So about a quarter to, we'll reconvene.
18.
Okay, that, I don't think I've seen that. It is apparently on file as part of Exhibit C. But in there, it talks about 7 to 11 years as opposed to just 7 years. Is that my understanding?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I can take a look at that. I'm sorry. You said what page again, though? I didn't write
page
that.
Page 23.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Turning back then on continuing with the DNV report, back to page 19 of that, table 5.2, discusses the detection and verification, correct?
Yes, it does.
And that indicates for a leak less than 1.5%, in below ground pipe, it could take up to 90 days to be detected. Is that correct?
That's what the DMV based their analysis on. I think Brian Thomas will testify on the actual leak detection capabilities.
Okay. Looking again then at paragraph 17 of your direct testimony, and that's the one where you mentioned the 7 to 11 years, but then in the last sentence of that paragraph, you make use of the 7-year interval in reaching the opinion that that equates to a spill no more than once every 41 years at any one location in South Dakota, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, that's obviously just a statistical analysis. It certainly could happen more frequently than once every 41 years.
There is the potential for it to do that. However, I think DMV used a lot of conservative assumptions, so we're assuming that that would be a no more than.
Okay. Well, I know, you know, we just, in Aberdeen this last May, we had a 500-year flood, and you know, we certainly can't be guaranteed we're not going to have another 500-year flood next year, can we? I mean, it could happen, right?
That would be the statistics, yes.
Okay. And even if it is once every 41 years, this pipeline is supposed to be around for 50 years. So we're looking at least they're saying there's going to be at least one leak on the pipeline in South Dakota.
Again, what we're talking about is statistics. And then statistics are expressions of a probability. And again, I've used the analogy in my – I don't know if you want to go through my direct testimony. I think we talked about the analogy with a car insurance, and I don't know if we want to go through that again.
We can read it. But I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry, I had just a couple more questions on that DNV report. Put away too soon. Page 24.
Of which version?
The one I was, the May 06 version.
Thank you.
That indicates under in the second paragraph below the graph that approximately 53.5% of the spills would be from pinholes. Is that right?
That's what it says.
And then going under in the next section, section 6.2, in general, reported incidents over decades provide a good basis for estimating spill volumes and frequencies for new pipelines. However, there are weaknesses in the use of that data. Small volume spills are significantly underreported, correct?
That's what it says. And again, I would say that, again, we testified earlier about, you know, small volumes, the less than 50 barrels spills, you know, they are reported more frequently now with the change in the PHMSA reporting criteria, but they have been decreasing. And the majority of the volume, 98%, is these larger spills, 50 barrels or more.
And then it mentions extremely infrequent events may not have occurred during the period of data collection of incidents. What does that mean, if you know?
Let me just read it, but I think I do know.
Okay.
What I think there's DMV is saying in this case is that highly improbable events, so a very large spill, may not have occurred during the period the data set, the time period the data set was collected.
Okay, I think I'm done with that then. Paragraph 19 of your direct testimony on page 6, which would be the top of page 6, states that Keystone will adopt a number of measures to minimize the chance of a pipeline leak or spill. You've been here through the course of the testimony over the last couple of days. Is that right?
I was here today. I was listening on the Internet yesterday.
Are there any measures to minimize leaks or spills that you're aware of that haven't already been discussed by all the other witnesses who have testified?
I believe that a lot of them have been discussed. A lot of them are in the PHMSA waiver. I think there's a lot of things in the regulations. And I believe Brian Thomas will be coming up and talking about some other things, too.
Nothing pops out with you, though, that hasn't, that would fall into the category of a number of measures that you talk about in your direct testimony?
Nothing, no.
Paragraph 21 on page 6 says the majority of the pipeline, approximately 80%, is underlain by low permeability soils. Is that a reference to the entire pipeline or just the South Dakota section?
That is actually a reference to the entire pipeline.
All right. Do you know what that number would be in South Dakota?
I don't have a percentage, but item number 22 talks about shallow aquifers, and then we talk about sandy soils. I do have a number for co-located along. That's 8.15 miles. Now, that doesn't necessarily equate, though, to – these are sandy soils, so that's a the surface soils, there might be confining layers between those, so it doesn't necessarily equate necessarily directly to the vulnerable aquifers. Okay.
Paragraph 23 refers to a recent report evaluated over 5 sites with BTEX contamination. Is that report on file?
That actually says 500 sites.
What did I say?
5.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
All right.
The citation, when I came out of a Minnesota Public Control Agency that's on the web. There's also the U.S. EPA in 1999 published information on this. There's quite a number of references that go back to these studies.
Okay. Well,
it's not filed on – I don't think it's been filed with the commission.
Okay. This is just referring to one particular report, is it not, though, that statement?
Yes.
Okay. And that report isn't on file as far as you know?
That is my understanding.
Page 9 would be part of paragraph 26, refers to the Bemidji spill and notes that it was caused by defective pipe manufactured in the 1950s. Do you know when the pipe that was involved in the more recent incident in Clearbrook, Minnesota was manufactured?
I do not.
Couple questions about the American Water Works Association study that you have attached to, I think it's your first rebuttal testimony. Or, is that right?
All right.
There's both a study and then another document. Would this be called an abstract or a summary, that first document?
The first document is the website by the AWWA Research Foundation.
Okay.
And basically just provides an overview of the document.
Okay. Looking at that, the website from AWWA, under the background section. It talks about pollutants from leaking storage tanks, and I understand we don't have any storage tanks involved, but if there were a leak of a substantial amount of product, would the soil be considered contaminated?
Yes, it would.
Okay. And it states then that contaminated soils can and have posed serious threats to the longevity and structural integrity of plastic pipes and elastomeric gaskets, which in turn can affect the water quality in the distribution system. Do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I would agree with it. However, that was the reason that they did this research. And what they have shown is that when they talk about contaminated soils, they're looking at what they were looking at was gasoline, benzene, toluene, TCE, those compounds. They were looking at a variety of pipelines, too. They were looking at polyethylene, vinyl carbonate, the PVC, and ductile iron. What they said was that some pipes, the results, if you want to get back to what the results say, is basically PE pipe, polyethylene pipe, is not very good at protecting against contamination. PE pipe is actually used, it was another more work out of the same group, is it's 0.018% of all water mains are PE, so it's not a commonly used water main. For PVC pipe, basically they said PVC pipe, this is under the second page under PVC pipe, says it's impervious to gasoline because there's basically not enough BTEX in the gasoline to swell the PVC and cause permeation. So the spills of benzene, toluene, and TCE, now those would be the solvents, not, they'd be in isolated compounds. Those in direct contact with those solvents, that could permeate, but it would have to be the solvent itself or groundwater concentrations greater than 60% maximum solubility. So we actually talked to the author of the study, and his results, what was in here, what's in my testimony, basically gasoline is not going to cause a permeation of PVC pipe is what I learned, and the BTEX concentration in crude oil pipelines is significantly less than that in gasoline. So what I learned was that these studies are showing that something with concentrations of BTEX as low as crude oil would not be permeating PVC pipe or ductile iron.
Do you know what type of pipe is used in the rural water systems in South Dakota?
It would be secondhand knowledge. From what I've heard, my understanding is that it's PVC pipe and ductile iron. But I'm not. That's wasn't firsthand knowledge.
The highlights on the web page mentioned that BTEX will permeate gaskets. Is that right?
It can permeate the gaskets, and so again, having talked with a guy and reading this research, basically, what he's saying is if you got gasoline surrounding these pipes, that the gasoline can permeate through the normal gaskets that they use. But as long as the recommendations of the American Water Works Association's Research Foundation now is basically as long as you keep a minimum flow in there, you won't exceed the maximum contaminant level for these compounds. If they were to stop the water and stagnate it, that was the only gasoline-saturated groundwater, that's when those could potentially pose a problem. But he said, and what I've read is basically this gasoline contamination surrounding the pipeline, again, heavy, very high-level contamination, and with BTEX concentrations in the crude oil being as low as they are, the expectation was that probably would not even be an effect, especially, again, if you keep a minimum water flow, there would not be any issues. And they come down to the end and they talk about their recommendations, and they said that the gaskets that are already there are satisfactory. And other considerations engineering considerations other than permeation should be used to govern the material selection. They basically say that PVC pipe is suitable. Long-standing recommendations and practices for these pipes and gaskets in hydrocarbon contamination have been unnecessarily conservative.
He also concludes on page 17 of the actual report that utilities prefer copper services in areas of known contamination, and replacement with copper was the corrective action for all reported permeation incidents involving domestic services.
Correct, and that's for a service line, not a main distribution.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I believe PE is used a lot more on service lines, too.
Was there any particular person that you dealt with at DENR?
I did not. The people I was in charge of actually were the ones that actually consulted. I believe it was Brian Walsh and there was a second person that they had a conversation. I think actually a third person was brought into one conversation about the Marshall area because they just wanted to make sure they got the right answer.
Right answer to what?
Whether we were concerned about where our pipeline was in relationship to these source water areas. We wanted to ensure that these source water areas would be basically they were protected from a spill, and that when we talked to them about these areas, they talked to us about the overlying till, the depth of the actual well. They actually went and looked at the bore logs to look at the lithology to ensure that in the event of a spill, again, this would be low permeability soils, and the well depth was sufficient that they were comfortable where our pipeline was.
Thank you, ma'am. That's all I have.
Commissioners, do you want to proceed or take a break or forge ahead? You guys okay?
If we're going to go for a while, I would appreciate a break. I might be scooting out here by myself, then.
Are we okay with a break? Do you want to? What do you want to take at this point? 10-minute break?
We'll say 7 and mean 10.
Okay. All right. At this moment, it is 4:25, if my eyesight serves me right. So about 4:45, we'll reconvene.
In 1870.
The hearing is reconvened. Oh, wait a minute. We got to find our reporter. It'll be just a minute here while our court reporter gets off a phone call and. Yep. Well, she has a tough job to do at these things and small children as well to take care of. So. Are you ready to go, Ms. Tilquist?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Mr. Hone, you have the floor.
Thank you. I have a few questions for you. On the well, which you and Mr. Rasmussen were referring to as the Sunset Colony well, it's on the first sheet of this handout you gave us today, TC-16. It's just west of MP-227.
Yes.
How familiar are you with that well?
I do know some things about the general lithology in the area, the groundwater movement.
Do you know the depth of that well?
I know that was in the discussions that my company, ENSER, had with the South Dakota DENR, and that was part of the reason for their comfort. I don't recall what the depth was.
Was that research done by others and then reported to you? Did you do it personally, or was that reported to you?
That was done by others and reported to me. Part of my job is to oversee their work, and as a risk assessor, I have to have knowledge of how a variety of things, including geology and aquifers and groundwater movement, in order to evaluate effects.
On page one of your direct testimony, you list yourself as an environmental toxicologist. Are you also a risk management assessment person?
I am a risk assessor, an environmental toxicologist and risk assessor.
So would you be in the same league as DNV? I mean, would you say that you have the same qualifications as DNV, risk management consultant?
We do different types of things. DNV specializes in pipeline risk assessment, yes, but they're doing failure analyses, spill volumes assessment. They do a lot of the engineering, you know, the hydraulics, those types of things. I would say we complement each other.
Okay. When did you do any field assessment yourself from the North Dakota line to Yankton? Go out in the field and do field assessment, or did you have other parties, either contract parties or employees, do that for you?
Both. I was in the field a little bit.
And a little bit, define a little bit.
I was at the Yankton River crossing and the area around there.
Was that in conjunction with a public meeting that was held there by the PUC?
No, it was not.
So it was a separate visit.
It was a separate visit.
And what was the purpose of being at Yankton, that crossing, in terms of your trip?
We were looking at the site, trying to determine if it was an appropriate crossing location. We're looking at the general lay of the land. I was there with some engineers. They were looking at different, things, and I was looking at, environmental considerations.
Sure. Were you specifically personally in Marshall County?
No, I was not.
Day County?
No.
Clark?
No.
How many of the counties crossed with this pipeline have you personally been in?
Other than the area around Yankton, that's where I've been.
Yankton was the only county you've been.
I have personally been. Our representatives have been up and down the line.
I understand. But in terms of you personally, as the lead environmental assessment person or one of the lead people assessing the environmental impacts, the only county you've been in is Yankton.
That's correct.
Crossed by this pipe. Okay. I'm going to go through your direct testimony and then go into the rebuttal. That way it'll be easier to page through for everybody involved. And I don't have questions on a lot of it, but I may, the things that Mr. Rasmussen brought up, I'll try to not repeat with deference to Mr. White. On page 2, item 7, in the third line of your answer, shallow aquifers have the greatest potential, generally speaking, for sources of water, since the pipeline would be buried at a shallow depth that's unlike the construction or operation of the pipeline will alter the water yield or supply used for drinking water purposes. Are you testifying that that applies to Marshall County?
Yes.
And how about Day County?
Yes.
Clark?
Yes.
Beadle?
Yes.
Hansen?
Yes.
Well, I just want to make sure. Let's see. Turner? McCook?
I'm assuming you're going through all the counties that the crime crosses.
And really, there's no shallow water in any of those counties that you're crossing.
That's not what I'm saying.
Well, let me re-ask the question then. Where the pipeline route goes in the counties where you personally haven't been, is there shallow water that your pipeline crosses, yes or no?
Yes, there is.
And what places would that be?
My understanding is the greatest concern is in the northwest corner of Marshall County. That's the area where the aquifers are the closest to the surface. And based on geological cross sections, plotting that our line across these geological cross sections, which look at the lithology, there is the vast majority of the state is then covered by clays and tills that would have low permeability and prevent permeation of any spill if it were to occur.
Excuse me, but we're not asking about the vast majority of the state. We're asking about the pipe route, either side of that pipe
route. I'm referring to the lithology under the
rest
pipeline.
Of the pipe. So you're saying that the shallow water, not based on your personal inspection, but based on reports and logs and things you've seen and maybe field visits by others, you're basing your assumption that the only place there's shallow water is in Marshall County?
That is my second, yes.
How shallow is shallow in Marshall County, based on what you've heard or from others?
I think what we have said is that there's shallow and superficial aquifers in Marshall County in general. Again, a shallow aquifer would be 50 feet, and then a superficial aquifer could reach the surface.
I'm looking at TC-16. This is the map you handed out today, and it's in evidence. The map, your map, your pipe is shown as a black line with MP-2115, 216. That's the milepost, right?
It's green, but yeah.
Okay, I'm colorblind, so I'm black-green.
That's close.
The dark line with those numbers next to it.
That's it.
What's the source of the base map that this was put on, if you know?
This is a USGS topographic map.
So it's a government map that's recognized in the industry as a base for this kind of purpose.
Yes.
Mapping. Okay. My eyesight is probably not as good as yours with your glasses, and I don't have my bifocals with me, but I can read parts of this, and there's one section I want to draw your attention to. If you will look at the location near map page 227, where your first dot, the Sunset Well, is. And then if you go up to map 226 and 225, just straight up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can we go 1, 2, 3 sections to the left? I assume those little squares are sections, correct?
Yes.
What does it say in the center of that section?
I guess I'm on the wrong one. I'm not seeing any writing in the one I'm looking at.
Well, let's if you look right where we show map page 225 and then go 1, 2.
Two over?
Yep.
You'll
see the one kind of lower to the left of you. What does that say there? Does that
the one I have to turn sideways to read?
Flowing wells?
Oh, that's not what I was looking at.
The text in blue on mine says flowing well. Is that correct?
Okay, what I'm seeing, a flowing well, is above 223.
That's fine.
Okay.
Is that what it says, is flowing well?
That is what it says.
Okay. Could we go 1, 2, 3 more to the left? And what does that say? It's flowing well on mine. I don't know if you can read yours.
Can you show me? Because I'm not seeing it.
Yes, would you, if you want
to, I'd be happy to
step over here. We started here at sunset. We went up 2 and then over. Yes.
So flowing well. Okay.
Yep. That says flowing well, right?
Correct.
In fact, if you look at this map in this section, map 1 of 10 on T16, there are flowing wells noted on this U.S. geological map in numerous places. Is that right?
There is.
That would indicate a shallow aquifer, shallow enough that the water actually comes up out of the ground, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, but there's also deeper aquifers where wells might be located out of.
Okay, I guess if you look at map page 2, same question. Now we're into Marshall county, Day County. The federal map we're looking at is the base map for what you use to show your pipe. It identifies flowing wells in various locations. The cluster that I'd refer to your attention to would be where it says Groton on the left side of the map, about
yes.
halfway down. 1, 2, 3 sections up and 4. There's 3 right there in those sections. Isn't
yes,
there?
I see that.
In order to have, my question is, that's a phenomenon of a flowing well, and I assumed you studied all the reports on groundwater in this area before you reached a conclusion. Did you?
I would tell you that we did look at aquifers in the region. We had a hydrologist that specifically looked at these, not specifically these wells, but this whole area. Again, and we looked at the fate and transport of a crude oil spill, and the we didn't look at this. I can't say these three wells in particular, but we looked at mechanisms of how a hypothetical spill might affect something, some groundwater.
And the conclusion? Your conclusion when you did that work?
The groundwater in the areas along the pipeline for the vast majority of the route are protected by glacial till and clays. Again, that would have low permeability. So if a spill occurred, again, it would have a hard time getting down to the aquifer. The location of the public well source, again, we looked at those in relationship and the distances from the pipeline. And, again, I mean, if a spill were to reach these, how far can it be transported? So we looked at all those different things with specific regard to northwest Marshall County. There is again, this gets back to my direct testimony, but there is a hydraulic connection between this area and James Aquifer, which is further over to the east. But, again, a spill would have to happen, and then it'd have to be traversing across the area to get to any water, to get into the James water supply, James Aquifer water supply.
When you say traversing, which direction would it have to traverse?
Well, the city of Britton is over to the south and east, and the groundwater is moving to the north and east.
And that is based on what?
That is based on South Dakota USGS data.
A study of the groundwater?
I believe they had our hydrologist showed me a map that showed groundwater directions through this area.
And it was a U.S. geological study?
I think it was. I'm believing it was the South Dakota Geological Service map. It's maps.
Do you know the year it was done? Published?
I do not.
I believe you've attended meetings, and if you've reviewed all the testimony, you've probably seen or reviewed the comments of David Wade, the manager of the rural water system at Britton.
Yes.
Where is the city of Britton's well on this map that we're looking at, TC-16?
I do not have personal knowledge of where it is.
Where is the BDM well on this map?
I do not have personal knowledge. My understanding, I don't have personal knowledge.
How would you know, then, that you're not impacting it?
It is not a source water area that is in close proximity. My understanding is that it's associated with the city of town of Britton. Again, the groundwater, my understanding is it would be moving away. Again, the distance that it would have to traverse was looked at by our hydrologist. The fate and movement of this oil is unlikely to be transported any significant distance.
Ma'am, I understand that you have a team of experts and technicians you work with, and they gather the data, you analyze it, and then you're charged with presenting the testimony. But you're making representations here that some would question, and I guess, did you personally look at that hydrology report and study it yourself?
I have seen it. I have a hydrologist that is very, very knowledgeable, and he has been trying to educate me, so I have an understanding of it.
Well, we're going to have a couple of hydrologists ourselves testify, and you, will you be staying for the length of the hearing?
Yes, I will.
Okay. Page 5. On 17, and this may be repeating something Reed Rasmussen asked you, but it's got a the back of the question is a little different. On that first paragraph there in 17, you're speaking about using the most frequent 7-year interval. This equates to a spill of no more than once every 41 years at any location along the 220 miles of pipeline in South Dakota. That's your statement.
That's the statement.
You're familiar, you heard people testify today about the accident, the tragic accident that occurred in Minnesota, correct? Did you hear that testimony?
Yes, I heard.
Are you aware that have you read any of the newspapers or stories about that accident and what occurred that brought it to the point of a failure?
I have read articles about it on the internet.
So have I. I guess the question is, based on the news stories, isn't it correct that there was a leak there within a week, two leaks within 1 week, a pinhole leak and then the failure?
That is not my understanding of the accident.
Well, if I gave you a news clipping that said that, would you doubt it?
My understanding was there was a pinhole leak. They went there to repair it, and it was... Again, this was the repair. Actually, again, we're getting a little bit out of my expertise, but it was basically when they were repairing it, that was the failure was because of the repair itself, not because
okay.
of the pinhole leak.
Let me take it one step further. Then, the pipeline we're speaking of is the Enbridge pipeline. Is that correct?
I believe that was correct.
According to the previous witness. There was a failure on that pipeline also at Cosette, Minnesota in 2003. I guess my question is Minnesota unlucky because they had two leaks within 4 or 5 years and we're not going to have one here for once in 41 years, according to you?
I'm going to object. This is a fishing expedition that's based on hearsay and speculation on a number of objectionable grounds.
Well, I think I'm going to sustain that.
Okay. On page 7, on the top of item 22, second sentence in that paragraph, would you read that starting at however?
However, the Middle James, also known as the Brampton, and Oaks aquifers in Marshall and Brown counties are shallow lake bed or buried channel aquifers with depth to ground or with depth to water generally less than 50 feet.
Would you consider an aquifer of less than 50 feet shallow?
I believe that is the definition.
And that description would be the northeast part of Marshall County, would it not?
Northwest.
Northwest, I'm sorry.
Yes.
That's where your pipeline's going through, correct?
There is a portion of it that goes through that area.
In fact, it goes through the whole west edge of Marshall County.
Yes, I believe that's true.
On page 8, item 25 of your direct testimony, first paragraph, could you read for us the last sentence of that first paragraph?
The groundwater in the area is susceptible to contamination because the soils in this area are sandy, parentheses high hydraulic capacity, and the groundwater is shallow, ranging from zero surface water to 35 feet below ground surface.
And you're referring there to the oil spill at Bemidji, Minnesota, that was in 1979. Is that right?
That is correct.
So that aquifer was approximately 35 feet below the surface. The aquifer or the spill?
The aquifer, the groundwater, was 35.
Right. And it was sandy soils, right?
Correct.
Isn't that a fairly close description to what you just described in the north, the western part of Marshall County?
I believe it is.
And you're putting an oil line through there?
Yes, we are.
To your knowledge, in the study that you did as an environmental scientist and the lead scientist or expert on this project, are there any farms in that area that have private wells that would draw water out of that shallow vein of sand?
I have no knowledge of that.
Did you research that?
I did not.
Did you check with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources to see if you could answer that question readily by some source of information?
I did not.
Did you ask the Department of Water Rights whether they had water rights on wells, private wells in that area?
I did not.
Is it so you're putting a pipeline within a mile of farm buildings and homes and Hutterite colonies and so forth, isn't that correct? Livable structures.
Yes.
Do you suppose those people might have a water source like a well, or how do they get their water, would you assume?
That would be probable.
Probable meaning they get it from a well?
Yes.
Page 10, item 28. In your answer, the third line down, where the starts out the word Keystone, it states that Keystone had submitted a preliminary risk assessment and environmental consequence analysis to the Department of State. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Did that preliminary assessment change? Is that different than what we're looking at today, I guess, is what I'm saying? That it must have been some months ago. That was in, what, 2006?
I don't understand the question.
Well, let me restate the question. You submitted preliminary risk assessment and environmental consequences to the Department of State, State Department. And when was that, if you know?
I don't know the precise date. I want to say I don't know the precise date.
The approximate date. But you did your work. It might have, not when it was filed necessarily, but when you did your work.
I believe there was, and I may not have the dates right, but I believe there was a preliminary assessment. I want to say it was done in March, and then there was a revision done in July. But that's...
Of what year?
2007.
Excuse me?
2007.
2007. Was anything filed in 2006, as far as you know?
The only thing I was hesitating before was I was trying to remember if that was March 2006 or 2007. I don't recollect. There has been two assessments that have been filed, preliminary and then a final to the final risk assessment for the Department of State.
I guess the question... Those must be big deadline dates for you as a consultant working for this client, just like this hearing would be. So it's probably one of those things that's burned in your mind and you blanked it out, and I don't blame you. But the issue is, at some point something was submitted to the State Department, and now something has been submitted here to the PUC. There's been a gap of time mm-hmm. between those submittals. Has anything changed majorly in your assessment from submission to the Department of State to the submission of this commission?
Which submission from the Department of State?
She submitted, it says that there was a preliminary risk assessment submitted to the State Department, and now there's information she's submitting to this body. My question is, there was a gap of time. Has that changed from when you submitted to State Department data to what's been submitted to this body?
I would say I mean, we continue to evolve and look at things. We have not updated the risk assessment. As we've discussed in multiple questions here in the rebuttal testimony and questions from everybody else, I mean, we're continually gathering data. It has not been updated. We're really waiting for the final EIS so we would have a route. And then we can go back and do further evaluation.
Okay, thank you. Let's move to your rebuttal testimony then. And the only one I think I only have one. If you have more than one, we'll need to determine when it was signed. That's the first one. Okay. The one I have under item 3, your rebuttal was referenced to Dan Hannon, Brian Murdoch. Is that?
I see that.
Is that the one you have? Okay. I just want to make sure I have the right one. On that first page at the bottom, A, after item 4.
Yes.
You referred to, thank you. You referred to the last two sentences. Keystone will develop and implement a risk-based integrity management system, IMP. When is that done? When is that completed, as far as you know?
I would defer most of those questions to back to Mayor Cathari, but my understanding is that it needs to be in operation prior to the operation of the pipeline.
This is your rebuttal testimony, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you put it in writing and stated it, you wouldn't know the answer to that?
You're asking me for the precise timeline of when Keystone is planning on doing that.
Well, you made a statement that this risk-based integrity management program will be developed.
Yeah, they are required to by federal regulations.
But you don't know exactly when.
I believe it is. Again, I think it's – no, I don't want to provide a date because I want to be
– okay. And the methodology to assess and mitigate risk associated with all pipeline segments includes HCAs, right? Next page.
Hello. Yes, that's what it says.
Well, page 2, if you go to the top of the page and look to the last sentence or two of that statement, if you want to just take a minute to look at it, then I want to ask you a question.
First paragraph, last couple sentences?
Top page of 2, 4 lines down where it says, as Keystone collects. If you want to just read that and then I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
I guess the question is this. How preliminary is the environmental information that your applicant that you work for is asking this commission to grant a permit to build a 30-inch oil line, which is maybe not unusual for some areas, but for us it's unusual. How preliminary?
To testify in his question.
I apologize.
I object to that. Just ask the question.
The question is this. How preliminary is the information at this point when your applicant is asking for a permit to build?
I would say that the having been involved with a number of different pipeline projects, the stage that Keystone is at is far beyond anything I have ever experienced. So I would say they're well beyond the norm for this stage of the process.
On page 5, page 2, Item 5, Mr. Hammond's, you're responding to Mr. Hannon, who's an expert for the state.
Yes.
In that answer, two lines down over to the right, downstream proximity criteria, distance selected for the preliminary risk assessment was 5 miles. Mr. Hannon had a different number, offered a different number, is that correct?
Yes, he did.
And what was his number?
I believe my recollection is 20.
20. And what does that mean in terms of what he's saying and what you're saying? What does that mean? What are you saying? What's the difference between the two of you?
Well, I'm evaluating 5 miles downstream, and he's evaluating if a spill got into a flowing stream channel. He wanted it evaluated to 20 miles, and it would be based, ultimately it'll be based on stream flow velocity and a expected emergency response times.
Okay. So he's saying he thinks it's 20 miles that the applicant would need to respond to. You're saying five.
Saying we use 5 miles as a preliminary assessment tool. Simply, one of the reasons we use that was some of these streams are intermittent. Some of them are perennial. As a good rule of thumb, it was just a distance we could look at to get for NEPA processes and for these types of processes, we're trying to show a range of a potential effects.
And the factor that's going to determine which of you are right is the amount of water that might flow down a creek in any given time. Is that a good example or question? That's a question.
It will be the stream, again, repeating what I just said, it'll be the stream flow velocity, the presence of water in an intermittent stream, and the reaction capabilities of the emergency response team. So, again, we'll have to be working back and forth with the emergency response team because it's not going to be probably a set distance. It's going to be working back and forth with the emergency response team saying, this is the distance in these areas based on stream flow and, again, emergency response times.
And so the coordinated effort would be you would try, based on what you stated in your rebuttal and what Mr. Walsh or Mr. Hanahan in his testimony, you would develop a plan that would estimate where you would, what locations you would try to catch this spill and contain it. Is that what the objective is?
That would not be my job. I'd be working in coordination with their emergency response team.
But the overall objective of whoever all is working on it is to try to stop it before it goes too far. Is that what you're doing, trying to catch the spill and from moving?
Yeah, the idea behind any containment would be to contain it as quickly as possible.
Okay. Are you familiar with the elevations of the Coteau Hills through Marshall County?
I am familiar with the general topography.
And this map, TC-16, stops at Britain. So you don't necessarily see the Coteau in that map 1, do you, except in the very lower right corner, elevation change.
That would be correct.
Could we go to the second page? And if you look at map page 2, what are we seeing in the lower sort of right-hand corner of that map?
That is the area you're referring to.
The Coteau.
Yeah.
Which is a higher elevation than where your pipe is routed.
Yes.
Do you know how much higher it is on average through those various what's the range? What's the highest elevation the Coteau contributes to elevation in terms of going draining through your area?
I would have to go through and look at the topography and look at the topo lines to determine that.
Okay. Could we go to map page 3? We're just going down through your exhibit.
Yep.
And is the pipe now, with all the MPs next to it, is close to the elevation there, isn't it? The elevation change.
It's close to the base of the foot of this, yes.
That elevation change is higher than where the pipe is. You would assume.
That's my understanding, yes.
You haven't looked. Have you looked closely at any of these elevation changes before this?
I'm aware of this, yes.
Okay. So I guess my question is, all along here you'll see blue lines that indicate creeks and streams, correct?
Correct.
Is it fair to say that the Coteau is providing the water for those creeks and streams and the drop in elevation?
I would say runoff from the Coteau.
So the runoff of all those blue lines across your black line, that's a point where a creek and stream is crossing the pipe multiple times in these three maps we've looked at.
Yes.
If there's a leak on the line, the pipeline,
mm-hmm.
anywhere along where one of those creeks or streams crosses, it has a potential for moving, the water drainage would have a potential for moving the oil, wouldn't it?
If the intermittent stream were flowing at the time and if the spill were large enough to get into the stream channel.
Okay. Now, if the oil leaks out of the pipe, and you're saying it won't go far, it'll sort of contains itself, it stays near the pipe. Let's say that happened in November. And in the spring, there's a heavy snow pack in these hills and the creek starts running. Can that move later as a delayed movement?
You're assuming that, a spill would occur. A spill would not be detected and
yes.
remain there. So those are your assumptions.
Yes.
Could it then be mobilized if, I would suggest that much of this may be in the trench. Anything that was above the surface might be mobilized by melt and runoff. Yes.
Because your pipe will cross these creeks, won't it?
Yes, it will. There would also be the opportunity for, I would suggest, also opportunity for detection by aerial patrols and those things, too.
I understand.
Okay.
We can move on now to a couple others that I have. On page 5, item 10, again, you're talking about HCA, and I'm not going to get into the super secrecy of HCA, but I just want to ask, when you get in that last, in your answer, 1, 2, 3, fourth line down, or third line down, I'm sorry, Keystone is responsible for considering the specific circumstances of their pipeline in the vicinity of HCA's and determining the analytical assumptions that are appropriate. Did I read that right?
That's what it says.
So you have the responsibility and apparently the authority to make that judgment.
I
object. There's no foundation for her to determine the authority.
Well, she says they're responsible and the determining the analytical assumptions that are appropriate. So the pipeline does that on their own. And that's a question.
I guess I don't know whether it is or not. Do you know the answer to that?
I will tell you that verbiage, I believe, is taken verbatim out of the Q&A, frequently asked questions on the OPS Integrity Management website. I believe that's where it came from.
Okay. Well, on the bottom of page 5, then, just to follow up with that, read that last sentence for me, would you? My voice is kind of drying out here.
The last sentence of that paragraph, starting Keystone will?
Yes.
Keystone will incorporate stream flow rates and terrain to assure the analysis is reasonably conservative. Is that the one you wanted read?
And the rest of it.
PHMSA may review the technical basis for these assumptions during integrity management inspections.
Did your analysis, your environmental analysis, looking at all these creeks, and just on these two pages, they look like there's hundreds of them. Did you analyze the flow on all of those to determine?
I do insist, Mr. Hearing Examiner, the testimony that's being offered during these questions really does need to stop. Let's have a question and not a. We didn't need to hear that there were hundreds of streams. I don't know that that's been testified to anywhere today.
I'm looking at your exhibit.
When you're on the stand, you'll have a chance to testify.
I understand. Heidi, would you look at page 1, 2, and 3?
I will sustain the objection in terms of the characterization of hundreds, but you may ask the question with respect to streams.
Heidi, we've been looking at map pages 1, 2, and 3. I'm not going to ask you to estimate the number of creeks, but would it be fair to say that there are a number of creeks on these three pages?
There are a number of creeks on these pages.
And of these three pages, not the whole 220-mile route, because if we looked at the rest of the map, we might see something similar, but just these three. In your analysis as the environmental agent or officer looking at this expert, did you have the quantities of water coming down all those creeks as you looked at the possible impact if there was an oil spill in this area?
Again, many of those would be intermittent streams, so there probably isn't flow rate information available for many of those. And yes.
An intermittent stream can still create enough volume to create an issue near your line. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Page 6, under item 12, you're refuting or responding to rebutting the testimony of David Wade. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And he's the manager of the rural water system, BDM Rural Water?
That is correct.
Okay. In your statement, you said Mr. Wade states that the right-of-way would pass, does serve a recharge area for the, serve as a recharge area for the James Aquifer. That's what he stated and you're restating. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Okay. Do you disagree with his assessment of how the aquifer that he manages and uses for a water source is recharged?
I object. Where's the testimony that he uses that for a water source?
She's responding to his testimony. She's rebutting his testimony is what I think she's doing in the statement.
But there's no foundation for this question.
Well, let me back up and give you foundation. You reviewed David Wade's testimony, correct?
Yes.
And what did Mr. Wade say about his aquifer, how his aquifer is recharged?
I would have to go and look through his testimony.
But I know it's been a while maybe since you looked at it, but based on what you've stated here in this paragraph, if you want to take a moment to read it, he's saying one thing and you're saying another. Isn't that correct?
I think he's speaking in generalities, and I think what we're saying is where this pipeline is located, having looked at the location of it based on geological cross-sections, we have more, you know, because he was looking at it as kind of macro level. We actually looked at it. Here's our pipeline. Let's look at the lithography, and this was the conclusion that we reached.
So yours is looking at it on that 100-foot corridor, your assessment, and he's looking at the overall system.
I think he's saying that this is in the northwest, you know, this is where it's coming from, and what we're saying is that is the case, but here's where we are based on the lithology, and this is where we're talking about. The subsequent testimony falls based on the geological cross-sections that were looked at.
Okay. Page 8 of your rebuttal, I guess it's the fourth paragraph down, starting out with the words, in summary.
Yes.
Would you read that, and then I want to ask you a question.
Could you please not? I've read the testimony. I guess I don't understand. I'm sorry.
Well, I'd like to ask.
Why does she have to read her own testimony again?
All right. You've got a summary that states the outlying water supply pipes are not anticipated to be impacted. Is that right? Even if
yes.
A spill near the water mains were to occur?
Correct.
Based on, what was your basis for that?
The previous several paragraphs in my analysis, my reading of the research that was done by AWWA and my discussions with James Gaunt, the lead researcher of that project.
Okay.
That research.
The exhibit that's attached to this rebuttal, the American Water Works analysis, yes, you have it there in front of you. Did this study look at the effects of tar sands oil on plastic pipe?
No, it did not.
And what petroleum products was it analyzing?
It was looking at gasoline, benzene, toluene, and TCE. Now, with the exception of TCE, those are all compounds, or the base compounds that he was concerned with are, again, the BTEX compounds, which we talked about before, and it was looking at how fast those compounds would traverse into the PVC pipe and other types of pipe.
And
I did ask Mr. Gaunt about the crude oil.
Sure. And as I think you stated earlier, and it states in the report, this study, that if lines are kept flowing, if the water can be kept flowing in the plastic pipe, mm-hmm. you can stay below the level of toxicity that is not allowed in water systems. Is that correct?
It is below the MCL. It's not a toxicity value. It's a drinking water standard.
And the MCL, MCL means what? What's the definition?
Maximum contaminant level.
Maximum contaminant level, as long as you keep the water flowing.
It's like with a minimal average flow, it can be, you can maintain, assuming again, so this is these pipes with the minimum average flow in heavily contaminated areas, you can still maintain it below the BTEX MCLs.
Did you speak with Mr. Wade or any rural water system about whether they have lines that, that go stagnant at times?
I did not.
If a water line, a service line to a home, was not being used at night, let's say from 10 p.m. to 6 in the morning, would that be stagnant? No water moving?
Yes, it would. But we're not, this study, again, was talking about gasoline saturated groundwater. You know, again, we're talking about a crude oil, which has a lot lower VTEX compound, which would not have the nearly the impact.
I understand. You submitted this as an exhibit,
okay,
right?
Fine.
And what, you, what it's saying then, essentially, is if there's a line that goes stagnant and doesn't flow for a length of time, you can get, you can have a problem with that. It can penetrate the pipe and exceed the MCL? Is that what it's saying?
I think he's saying they had an eight-hour stagnation in saturated groundwater is the example they mentioned for gasketed pipe.
Okay. I just have one last question on this, and we maybe in the future there will be more. But if I'm looking at the report you gave us, and I'm looking at page 5 now of the study itself.
Yes.
The initial document we were looking at was a summary or a
No, it's it, it isn't. It is, it, it is that summary page is the AWWRF has basically done a number of research studies, of which this is one study, and this is the they're, so they're coming out with a kind of overall summary document to provide guidance to water
okay.
users.
And this would be this that was
this
a summary.
Key, this
and
is the key one of these.
And this is the. Then we're into a full. There was a, there's a full report near the end, right? Or attached. I don't, it isn't numbered, but
this is the yeah. This is the their, one of their research papers. Yes.
So, at, what I see is page one, and at the top it says performance of plastic pipes.
Yep.
So that's a full paper, a full report, right?
That is yeah. That is one of the papers. Yeah.
Okay. Could you go to page 9? There are two charts on that page, two tables. What is that showing, both for toluene and TCE?
Let me just read through this. I just want to make sure I get this right for you.
Sure.
My understanding of this is basically this is showing permeation rates through PVC pipe for pure solutions of toluene and TCE.
Okay. And then could you go to the next page, 10? And there is another graphic, figure 11, penetration distance. Based on your review of this document, what do you think they're showing there?
They're showing how pure solvents can have a moving front through PVC pipe.
Okay. And then the next page, 11, these all tie together. They tie with the wall thickness and effect. What are they showing there as far as the summary on, as far as you can tell, in the summary on figure 11?
Figure 11 or page
11? On page 11.
Yeah. Okay.
Figure 12, I'm sorry.
Yeah. What that's showing is the movement, the moving front of toluene through PVC pipe when it is exposed to a pure concentration of toluene.
Okay. I think that's, yeah, but just let me check one last item here. Page 16 is three charts, and it relates to the same issue. Figure 16, page 16, thickness of swollen layer for a one-inch PVC pipe. Based on your review of this document, what's being shown there?
This, again, is showing the distance of the moving front, so how thick it is over time for a one-inch PVC pipe. With to solutions of either one of these compounds, toluene, benzene, or TCE, in a saturated aqueous solution.
Okay. Thank you.
Staff? Other interveners, pardon me. Mr. Miller.
I just have a couple questions here. Ms. Tilquist, you said that you've been working with the PHMSA database for several years. Is that correct?
Yes, off and on, yes.
And you stated that my analysis regarding my exhibits is incorrect.
What I'm suggesting is that what you said, the way you had presented it was that it incorporated all the data. What you had done was presented a summary, that used the summary data, which was a portion of the PHMSA database.
Okay. Now, in your direct testimony, you listed the average spill from the PHMSA database as 12 barrels. Is that correct?
That was correct, and I corrected that at the beginning of today.
Okay, and that correction was to what?
We went back to the SIR rebuttal testimony.
Yes.
Do you want me to go through that table?
Well, I guess I could add. You stated that it was 287 barrels?
I believe the mean was 287 and the median is 3.
Okay, so you changed it from 12 barrels to 287 barrels?
I would suggest that both values are appropriate for measures of average central tendencies.
And how would the 12 barrels be correct?
It was not correct. That's why we fixed it.
Okay, so when you said you met the both values, what did you mean by both values? That I assume
the,
you meant that
the table that we presented.
Oh, okay.
Presents both of those.
Okay. All right. I do have some other things, but I think they'd be addressed under my own testimony, so I have no further questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Staff, do you have any questions of Ms. Tilquist?
I do. Looking at your direct testimony on page 7, it's question number 22. In your answer, you
I'm going to catch up to you.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Page 7, 22. Okay.
Yep. You indicate a length of miles where you identified sandy soils. Just wondering how you estimated those particular miles. And I believe you did correct that number maybe. But just wondering your...
I'm not sure the data source for those surface soils, how they came up with. I'm not sure what the precise data source is. We could find that out for you if you'd like.
If you could find out, that would be helpful.
You guys write that down, please.
And I have nothing further. Thank you.
Commissioner, questions of Ms. Tilquist?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. You know, we've spoken a bit, we've heard you speak a little bit about the Bemidji oil spill today. You note in your direct testimony that over 20 years, the BTEX had moved a total of 170 yards from the crude oil source. Were there any other dissolved components or dissolved constituents that went further than that, do you know?
No, I don't know for certain, but typically benzene, BTEX compounds are the most soluble and they have the greatest mobility. That's typically why they're watching it.
Page 9 of your testimony, you note that with regard to photo 3, you corrected it to photo 3, and I'm looking about two-thirds of the way down the page here, that if that area were to be actively remediated, were there not requirements for that, all areas affected by that Bemidji spill to be remediated?
I'm not sure if I can answer that, but...
Well, I didn't lay any foundation for it, so...
were there any requirements that... I don't know. I don't have an answer.
Okay. Do you know, other than the environmental effects that you describe in your testimony with regard to Bemidji, do you know of any other effects in regard to humans or livestock or contamination of community water systems?
Bemidji was it's a state forest. One of the reasons they were looking at natural attenuation and things that at the time this occurred, it was not known that natural attenuation worked as well as it did. And one of the reasons that they didn't do a lot of stuff there was there is no immediate receptors in the area. There is a lake that's, I don't have the precise distance, but the groundwater is moving towards that lake, so they were monitoring that. And then, but it was the absence of receptors that caused them to take the level of action that they did. Then the USGS got involved and was monitoring it to see what was going on. So it's still an ongoing process.
On the projects that you've worked on in your professional experience, how typical has it been for pipelines to pass underneath streams or creeks?
It happens all the time. There's thousands and thousands of miles of pipe throughout the country. You can't route a pipe without crossing streams, perennial streams, intermittent streams, wetlands. You can't do it.
Are there topographic or geological issues at play in Marshall or Day County that are unique or that you haven't seen in other projects that you've worked on?
No, not at all. It's the areas that we're looking at, no, they are not unique.
Okay. That's all I have right now.
Other commissioner questions?
Yes. When you stated that oil is lighter than water, and the oil would actually come to the surface, say it was in an aquifer or anything, it's always going to stay on the top of that water. Is that correct? Is there any situation where the oil would continue to dilute and over time and contaminate an entire aquifer, or would it actually stay on the top?
In an aquifer, what you'll have again is so the oil is floating at the surface, you've got the dissolved constituents. As the volume of oil decreases because of the loss of these lighter weight constituents, the residual oil that's there does become heavier. There may be some over, and now we're talking long periods of time, there may be some downward migration of the oil with time.
Decades, years,
decades.
Okay. Could you explain to me that the 90% of the spills, or how many barrels and less? Could you explain that to me again?
Looking at the PHMSA database from 2002 to now, the 90%, so it's a kind of a cumulative probability curve, 90% of the spills recorded in that time period were 300 barrels or less.
Okay. And this is where I think I got pretty confused here. Is the intake of a rural water system an HCA?
The intake for where they would get their water possibly could be. It's the intake that would be the protected area.
That's a protected area.
It could be. Again, I'd have to look at the definition and see if it qualified based on the number of people and all that. But my understanding, it is sufficient size. So the intake, where they got the water from, mm-hmm. if it was surface water, because that's where the HCA would come into play. So the surface water intake for a community water supply is the HCA.
Okay. And are wells on a farm is not considered a public water system, though,
correct.
Is it? Okay. And then, a leak, any spill, a drop, what constitutes actually a leak for your studies in the environmental or risk assessment? What constitutes a leak?
I guess the PHMSA database has certain reporting criteria, I know Keystone considers. I think Ms. Kafari said that any leak is what they're.
Anytime oil touches the ground, it's a leak.
That's what they're reporting.
Okay. Do you consider the South Dakota DNR a good source for the water sources compared to other states that you've worked with? North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska.
Yes.
Our state is very comparable. Our DNR is very comparable.
I would say yes.
Okay. If it wasn't, what measures would you take? I guess I'm looking for something above and beyond that TransCanada would do to protect South Dakota water.
Well, I think part of the federal regulations state that basically if TransCanada, Keystone, is aware of an area that would qualify as an HCA, whether or not it was designated by South Dakota or wherever state they're in, it's their responsibility to incorporate that as an HCA into their integrity management plan within 1 year of that knowledge.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Thank you.
Commissioner Hanson.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I think I just have about three or four questions. The first is on page 10, on paragraph 28, you gave an answer at the very beginning. You said pipelines are the safest, most reliable, and most efficient mode of transporting large volumes of crude oil. And with previous witness, I had asked for specific information if it was available. Now I see it in your testimony. Do you have statistical information? Not that I am questioning your expertise, but I'm certainly interested in seeing.
I think there's been quite a few groups that have looked at it. There's AOPL has a website that talks about that. I think PHMSA's website talks about it. I believe the National Transportation Safety Board probably has information on that. And there's a very really well done article done by the Allegro Energy Group that looked at that as well.
Could you provide this commission with that information? I would appreciate that very much.
Based on your previous request, Commissioner,
it's in the works?
It is, yes.
All right. Thank you. Do you have experience with mitigation?
Some. It depends on, I guess. Yeah. Go ahead with your question.
Well, your testimony somewhat skirts around and weaves through some of the challenges of a spill, certainly, and potentially that a failure would need to be mitigated. And I have experience with two, unfortunately, as an elected official, two completely different types of failures, one of which was gasoline, a very large volume of gasoline. The other was a oil, and it was still a large quantity, but not huge. Mm-hmm. They're both mitigated completely differently.
Remediated? Is that what you're looking for?
I'll say remediated.
Okay.
Because we still have wells that are examining the flow of the of the gasoline and in the water supply.
Mm-hmm.
Although the oil was simply the soil was turned and aerated, and large volume, but some of it was taken away, but most of it was aerated. Do you have enough familiarity with mitigation that you would know what would be done in a situation of this nature? I know we have information on that, but I'm curious from your standpoint.
I'm not a I'm familiar with it, but that's not my expertise. I believe Brian Thomas is coming up next.
Right.
May be able to talk more about it, but that's not my area of expertise.
I appreciate your answering that way. I just wanted to see if I could get some information. you had also testified that Lewis and Clark promoters were aware of the other petroleum pipeline crossings when they pursued the intake and that it was an acceptable risk to them, I believe you stated. When in the placement of their intake, they were aware of other crossings, if I said other intakes, other crossings when they chose the location for their intake. Did you have any discussions with any of the Lewis and Clark?
Yeah, perhaps I wasn't misspoke, or they would. I'm assuming they would have knowledge that those pipelines were there, that okay. they would be upstream. I did not talk to them, but one would presume they'd be looking at those types of factors. But I did not talk to them.
Okay.
Those pipelines have been around for decades.
Right. But could not there have also been a situation where there was no other place to go for water, and so they had to go there for water?
Possibly. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Thank you. Your first correction that you made, I missed as we were making the changes. And if it's not too inconvenient for you, rather than me waiting for the, I suppose one of my compatriots here could help me with that. But could you do that again, please?
Page 6 of the direct testimony, item number 20. The third line from the bottom, we talk about spill sizes. And all I would do is refer you as a correction back to my SIR rebuttal testimony, page 2, table 1, and that provides statistics on spill volumes.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. That's all the questions I have.
Other commissioner questions? If not, I have a few for you,
okay.
If I may. Turning to page 2 of your direct testimony, and in item 7, Mr. Hone asked you some questions about that couple of paragraphs there.
Mm-hmm.
And the impression at least I got from his questions was he was attempting to imply that your testimony there related to water quality issues somehow related to leaks or spills. And my understanding of your testimony in those paragraphs, these relate to hydrologic impacts from the pipeline and from, in particular, pipeline construction and then the existence of the pipeline within that shallow, for at least paragraph 1. Is my understanding wrong?
Yeah, I think we talked about the construction of the pipeline. The construction or its presence, the operation, would not alter water yield. So that's talking about the hydrology, and yeah, we're not talking about the spill effects to that, not water quality issues.
This is just talking here about effects upon the actual ability of the aquifer to yield water.
Correct.
Okay, and in the second paragraph there we're just talking about the kind of incidental construction things such as a leak from a fuel tank during the construction project.
That's right. That's during construction.
Thank you. Now going to the flowing well issue, and I take it, do you have any background at all in hydrology?
Minimal.
Minimal?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the term hydrostatic pressure or hydrostatic head?
Yes.
And would you explain what that is?
It is the pressure from the water. So if for a flowing well, the hydrostatic, the pressure would be forcing the water out of the flowing well.
So by definition, in order for a well to be flowing, it must be under a condition of hydrostatic pressure.
That was my understanding, yes.
Can that happen in an area where the water formation is right at the surface?
That would, I don't understand how that could happen. My understanding is that it would probably be, the pressure would become from the water being present at pressure under depth.
And that requires there to be some form of gradient that pushes water within a confining layer in order to pressurize it.
That would be my understanding.
Did you have an occasion during your review of the hydrology analyses to take a look at those formations in this vicinity or in the pipeline route in general that function under hydrostatic pressure? Are you familiar with what those are?
I did not. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. With respect to, you know, Mr. Hone asked the questions about the presence of the coteau to the east of the town of Britain and really along much of the pipeline route, at least in the northern vicinity. And that coteau is a feature that defines the upper end of the surficial gradient, right, in the project area. Mm-hmm. And because of that, water flows from east to west throughout the entire area that we're talking about here.
I think that is correct, yes.
And is that the reason why in your rebuttal testimony in discussing Mr. Wade and BDM and their particular water source, that whole phenomenon is that why you made your determination that the risk to his particular wellhead is insignificant?
I believe that it was coupled with the depth of the clay and till also in the area.
In looking at the data from, and maybe there will be other witnesses that will deal with this, but in looking at the studies of the South Dakota Geological Survey, did your people have occasion to review the studies on the permeability characteristics of unoxidized till that occur in South Dakota?
Yes, they did.
And how would you characterize the results of those studies?
Unoxidized till is highly impermeable, is how it was described to me.
And in terms of the flow down from the coteau area or any other flow gradient, I guess, if you don't, then don't answer. But does a gradient across a particular reach of stream necessarily affect the velocity of that stream throughout the entire length of the stream?
I would think that the gradient would affect it at that particular location.
So in other words,
am I answering you?
Okay. I guess an example would be, does the fact that the Arkansas River coming out of the Rocky Mountains flows at an extremely high velocity mean that the Arkansas River... Oh. Do you need a break? We'll take a short break here to let our reporter, she's having a problem, I think an onset of a cold. We're going to reconvene. We took a slightly longer than 10-minute recess here. Ms. Heidi Tilquist is still on the stand. And I was in the process of asking you a question about the effect of gradient on areas that are significantly downstream. And I think I'm going to withdraw that. I think I was maybe Arkansas is a little far from the pipeline too. And so with that, I'll turn it over for redirect.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We have no redirect.
You're excused and may step down.
Thank you.
Now
I'm glad we took that break.
Yeah. Well, let us regroup a little bit. I think maybe now we need to talk logistics a little bit, guys. I'm assuming that Brian Thomas is going to be. I suppose we can. I guess we can.
We'll stay on the internet, so those people who have interest in following the schedule of the case will be on the internet, but maybe off the.
Okay, that's fine. Yep. Here are the dilemmas we're dealing with, and I'm assuming, I think we're getting pretty tired up here. I don't know if you guys want to go on and on tonight, because I'm assuming he'll be fairly lengthy.
I characterize Mr. Thomas as being about of the same length and depth that we've gone through with Ms. Tilquist, and I would ask not to start that tonight and then try and pick it up again in the morning. It's technical stuff that I think it's best myself.
What do you think, you guys? I mean, we had originally scheduled you guys to start in the morning, but...
I don't think we're scheduled to start until Thursday morning.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So
okay.
We're fine with that.
Okay, well, that'll work then. We have one other dilemma, and that is...
go ahead.
Ms. Winkler over here, as I understand it, you have to fly out...
On Thursday at 3.
On Thursday at 3.
I'm looking at the schedule right now, and we've amended it where it looks like Mr. Thomas will have tomorrow morning, and then at 10:30 we'll start with intervener testimony. Not that he'll be completed by 10:30, but intervener testimony will take up most of the mid-afternoon, and then there will be time again late in the day to pick up Mr. Thomas again.
And so what are we going to do about your witness?
Well, I'm thinking we've set aside most all day Thursday and all day Friday for Webb Water. If Webb Water would be willing to begin a few hours late Thursday, if she could go Thursday morning.
Yeah, that's fine. Roxy Geed's here, and she's kind of coordinating the witnesses we subpoenaed from the state, if that works.
Is that workable with you guys at all?
It is workable, although we may have to move one person onto Friday, if that's okay.
Oh, I don't. If it's okay with you, unless you guys care. Because, I mean, we're going to be here next week anyway, so, right, if we have to kick some testimony over to next week, that's the way it is, I think. And I wasn't aware of the dilemma with Ms. Winkler until today, I think, and so I apologize for that. I honestly didn't know that was a problem.
So do you have value, Mr. Smith, and do you see value in coming back on the record, doing a quick summary of what it is that you've outlined for a schedule, and so that we've got that?
Yes, let's do that. And again, I think I tried to emphasize, you know, in my memos I've sent out to people that we were going to have some flexibility on some of this because we can't predict how long things are going to take. Mr. Hone?
My question, I guess, is, and I'm not that familiar with the schedule, Reed, and you have talked more, but we have no objection if the PUC's expert witnesses went before us. Was there a reason they were at the end or staggered? Or?
It's just the normal flow of things here. It's the way things are usually done. Usually, because you have two sides, the PUC is staff, is they may or may not favor one side or other depending on their analysis, but they're not necessarily, unless it's a complaint case by us against somebody, when we have an advocacy position that's definitely got a point of view, normally the PUC tries to take a relatively analytical view of the things and try to stay relatively neutral, and that's why that's usually done.
And I would add one other thing. I mean, to the extent that the staff and their experts are trying to get at what's in the public interest and the truth, sometimes there's great value in having heard all of the other evidence by the more partisan sides so that that information can be incorporated. That'd be...
Okay.
Mr. Smith, I'd just observe, I from my perspective, Ms. Winkler's not a multi-hour long witness.
It didn't appear that way, you know, just from reading your testimony, but, you know, you can never predict sometimes, but it didn't seem that way.
That's true. I just wanted to observe that. It doesn't seem that way to me.
Well, should we go back on the record for a minute? And due to some witness conflicts and the fact that we didn't quite achieve as much in the last 2 days as we thought, the applicant's case in chief, particularly the testimony of Brian Thomas, will commence tomorrow morning at 8:30. Tomorrow morning, are we all on the same page with that? And then we have individual intervener testimony scheduled throughout much of the rest of the day. And either if we get time tomorrow, we have one witness for the staff, Brenda Winkler, who if we get available time tomorrow, we will attempt to take her tomorrow. And if we can't, then we will have to move her over to Thursday morning as she has a scheduling conflict. And then the DENR folks and state witnesses have agreed to that they're amenable to moving their appearances here back. Is that a fair recitation?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. So with that, we will stand adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning, and thank you all.